activists and civil rights advocates Fred and Mike Klonsky, Chicago Elevated tour guide Margaret Hicks, and live music from Split Single and Jason Narduzzi. And now here's your host, a man who celebrated Martin Luther King Day by giving back, Justin Kaufman.
Yes, giving back is returning. It was Christmas gifts that I needed to return, so I wouldn't say giving back. That's giving back. Yeah, I give back. I gave back to Kohl's, you know, as one does on Martin Luther King Day. How y'all doing? It's Justin Kaufman here on 720 WGN. It's a download with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We have an outstanding show on this rainy evening in the Chicago area. 312-981-7200 if you got something to say. Tonight, coming up right after the 7:30 news, we're going to have University of Chicago Professor Charles Lipson and Tracy Seffel in as guests on Touche. Both Dave and Chris are out tonight, but we will talk about NATO. Talk about the cabinet positions. We'll talk about the marches that are being organized around the both in D.C. and here in Chicago around the inauguration. And, of course, the Cubs trip to the White House. Do all that. Coming up at 8 o'clock, Fred and Mike Klonsky, two longtime civil rights advocates, activists here in town, both for politics, for education. Both of the brothers have been a part of Chicago's protest movement for over 50 years. I was looking up today some of the photos of Mike Klonsky sitting next to Fred Hampton, sitting next to Bobby Rush, you know, talking about politics and peace and the anti-war movement, and the Vietnam War, and a great little thin mustache. So see if he still has it tonight. Mike and Fred Klonsky, my guests at the big table tonight. We'll talk about Martin Luther King Day, about activism, about protest, about marching, all that tonight here on The Download. Coming up at 9 o'clock, we'll switch up and we'll talk to Margaret Hicks from Chicago Elevated, longtime guest here. She's been here on a couple different stories. She does Chicago Elevated, which is the walking tours around the Loop in downtown Chicago, other parts of Chicago as well. She spent the last week living off, in and off the Chicago's Pedway. You've known this. It's that mysterious place, you know, sort of series of tunnels and sidewalks and things that are underground in the Loop, somewhat abandoned, somewhat, you know, Blair Kamen had a big piece in Chicago Tribune about what to do with the space. There's been workshops this week at the City of Chicago. Margaret Hicks took it upon herself to just live down there for 7 days to stay underground and see if she could survive. She came up for air today, and she's going to be on the download tonight. So we'll talk with Margaret Hicks coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Also, Darsha Townsend, longtime Chicago food and drink journalists will be in to talk about what to expect from trends, hot restaurants, things in 2017. I'm looking for a new restaurant. I went to a great restaurant this weekend, One Fun Chinese restaurant in the West Loop. Austin Baker, who's going to be on our program next week. I went as, you know, research. It's awesome. You like Chinese food. This place was great. We'll talk with him next week. We'll continue the raise for that place next week, but we'll talk with Adarsha tonight. And Jason Narduzzi comes back in the program with his band Split Single. They are our guests in Studio 435 tonight. How great is that? Jason plays bass for Bob Mould, for Superchunk. He's been on tour with Liz Phair, Telekinesis, other bands. It's pretty, I mean, it's amazing musician, lives right here in Evanston. Great to have him on. It's awesome. Last time he was on, we just talked about his, I mean, amazing career in music from when he was 10. He was in punk bands playing on the punk scene. And I think Dave Grohl said he got into music. He was inspired to do what he did because he saw Jason play. Verbo is the band. So we talk. I'm so excited that he's going to perform live in studio tonight. So that's great. Split Single, part of Studio 435 tonight. So a big show. So why don't we get to it? News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. This is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We will return with the carryout. Stay with us. All right, it's The Download here on 720 WGN. We got a huge show lined up tonight, so why don't we get to it? We'll start with the carryout like we do every single night. This, of course, where I read the news. So you at home, you don't have to. Yeah. Here are today's top stories. This is the week. Come Friday, we will have a new president. President-elect Donald Trump was busy getting ready for the inauguration by doing an interview where he said NATO was pretty much obsolete. Oh, I thought, you know, you tried on different tuxes or maybe approved the three doors down set list. But no, Trump, he's unsettled Europe with his NATO talk and by celebrating a hard Brexit in the UK. Essentially, Trump is the equivalent of when Rodney Dangerfield shows up at Ted Knight's Country Club in Caddyshack. But instead of golf clubs and caddies and baby Ruths in the pool, it's global security. To make things normal again, Trump just tweeted about how bad SNL was. Hey, if you're truly interested in uniting the country, ripping on SNL, it's a great start. Bipartisan disdain for the aging variety show, it works. Although a sitting president talking about how bad Saturday Night Live is on Twitter, it's very, I don't know, a 13-year-old boy. I mean, have you ever gone to social media to complain about a TV show? No, you don't. You just don't watch the TV show. The Cubs visited the White House today, President Obama's last public event before he sends off. Three no-shows, Arrieta for family health reasons, John Lester and John Lackey, who, let's face it, probably did it for political reasons. I mean, I can't say for sure, but he just seems like a guy who would be like, nope, not in God's America. Trump! Also, Kyle Hendricks, Justin Grimm, come on, guys, wear a tie. Or at least go all beatnik poet like Joe Madden. Don't wear your checkered blue shirt that you got 2-for-1 at Express for Men. You're a world champ! Coincidentally, I have that same shirt on tonight. The Cubs got a great experience, though, and it was great to see all the players back together again, even the ones who signed elsewhere this offseason. A fitting end to a great Chicago season. So let's do it again starting in less than a month. Speaking of Chicago, the Justice Department's scathing report on police misconduct and need reform? That's last week's news. Actually, several aldermen stepped forward today and asked the Justice Department to investigate the city's law department. Alderman Wagesback and others want more transparency and say they can't make decisions with information provided by the law department because they essentially manipulate and withhold facts. This is somewhat true since judges have ordered the law department to hand over evidence a few times this last year, including the Laquan McDonald video. We'll see if a new Trump administration would call for an investigation, but they probably will because they'd be more investigating the Emanuel administration than law enforcement, and that's political, and Trump loves political. You saw the news this weekend, Ringling Brothers Circus coming to an end. The owner can't sustain the cost, and with mounting pressure to stop exploiting animals, the biggest circus is, well, not coming to town ever again. Everyone's worried about the animals, but I'm worried about the Eastern European trapeze family. I mean, where are they going to get work?
I don't know Excel, but I have done quadruple lutz on a tightrope 50 yards above with no net.
Great, you're starting a mailroom. Smartphone companies are working on a new way to deal with battery fires. Of course, some smartphones have been exploding and catching fire because of overheating lithium batteries. So what are they working on? Fire extinguishers. Yep, when the battery overheats, a miniature fire extinguisher would kick in. No word if said extinguisher comes in different colors. I would want fuchsia. So cute. Don't explode. In weather, it's rainy. It's freezy. It's freezy rainy. In sports, what can you say about the Green Bay Packers? Once again, the team meanders through the regular season, only to turn it up at the end. The Pack went into Dallas and beat the number one seed to advance to the NFC Championship game. They were able to win on a last-second field goal after Rodgers threw a laser to tight end Jared Cook with seconds to play. Reports are that Aaron Rodgers didn't even call a play in the huddle. He just went all playground and told the receivers where to go. Come on, really? I mean, if that were Jay Cutler, he'd been like, don't care what route you run because I'm just throwing a triple coverage because I want to go home. The Packers go to Atlanta next week. Also, did you see the Seahawks' Devin Hester turning back the clock Saturday? The former Bear was picked up off the garbage heap by Seattle for the playoff run. And his second game back, he proves he's the best kick returner in NFL history again. Hall of Fame, of course. Once again, so fun to watch players like Hester and Julius Peppers, not to mention former coaches Rod Marinelli and Dave Tobe in the NFL playoffs. The Bulls hit the halfway point in the season. Well, they're fitting 21-21. Jimmy Butler returned to once again play Superman. This dude, man, he's an under-the-radar MJ. Watching the game last night, it was like Jimmy Butler rising up with 2 minutes to play, hitting jumpers like a boss. It's very reminiscent of like a Kobe or a LeBron or a Jordan. The Bulls brass seems to be unconvinced, but I think we got something here. Just need to work on the other 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 players around him. The Blackhawks lost to the Wild last night 3-2. With that loss, the Hawks slide out of the top spot in the Western Conference. Makes a move down to the number 3 seed. Still a long way to go, though. The Hawks, after winning 4 in a row, have now lost 2. Did you see the weird NHL All-Star Game commercial during the NFL playoffs where Patrick Kane says, "Say hello to my little friend"?
The puck? The stick? What are you doing? Stick to the basics. Play a Fall Out Boy song and then skate into a Chevy. Done. Also, don't look now, but the Northwestern Wildcats men's basketball team surging. They throttled Iowa this weekend and they're currently third in the Big Ten behind Maryland and Wisconsin. They're 4-2 in the division and 15-4 overall. This is worth watching because, again, Northwestern has never made the NCAA tourney. I mean, come on, Austin Peay, Cleveland State, they've both been in like twice, three times. So you can understand why this is such a big deal. And finally tonight, Rogue One, the latest Star Wars movie, ended up being the top-grossing box office smash of 2016. It beat out all the other summer blockbusters. Something tells me that you could slap an R2-D2 beep, boop, 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 beep on a romantic comedy at this point and win the box office. So look out for Droid Rage, the new C-3PO vehicle starring Vin Diesel the summer after next. That's the carryout for January 16, 2017. Hey, happy Martin Luther King Day. I hope you got a great deal on a mattress or a couch. Maybe a mattress couch? Couch with a mattress?
Much more to come here on The Download. We're going to talk all things Trump. Coming up, we'll talk NATO. We'll talk a little bit about the cabinets. Also about the inauguration and the plans for protest this weekend, both in D.C. and Chicago. Tracy Seffel and Professor Charles Lipson in studio. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my man?
Oh, man, what a great weekend. You know, it was up and down for me sports-wise. Wow. I mean, the Blackhawks got shellacked Friday night. They got beaten last night by Minnesota. But my son's team, Justin, I'm proud to report, beat the opposing team last night, 11-6, and he scored a goal.
Hey, congratulations.
Oh, hockey man, it was really good. And my Steelers won, too.
What's a celebration like in the Martier house? Once you get a goal, you get a...
Like let's see. It's
bump in the
when we get home, bonus. It's a Dr. Pepper in the iPad. For
yeah,
a little bit.
There you go. That's what I want.
It's easy when you're 6 years old. That's you don't ask for much.
I'm 42. I'll take that.
That's right. Exactly.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay. I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
Well, that's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touché.
You go right.
That's right. It's time for Touche here, regular segment every Monday night here on 720 WGN, The Download. Charles Lipson and Tracy Seffel in for Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling tonight. Of course, Professor Lipson, a regular here on WGN, also professor of political science at the University of Chicago, contributor to Real Clear Politics. Also, Tracy Seffel is a regular as well, and she was a one-time staffer for Hillary Clinton's campaign back in what would have been 2008, right?
Yeah.
And also a... I would say, what would you call yourself? A consultant? Are you a consultant or are you a...
I am a consultant.
All right.
I consult.
She's a consultant. Good to see you both. All right. Let's get to this. So we got a lot to talk about. Tonight, the four things I think we should talk about are obviously the inauguration week. I think we need to talk about NATO, Brexit, and Russia because we have Professor Lipson here, of course. Let's talk about the cabinet and, of course, the Cubs, right? Why don't we do that in order? Inauguration week, it started off, I mean, there's been a lot of jokes about, you know, whether or not the Bruce Springsteen cover band's going to play or not. But this is a bigger thing. There are planned marches around the inauguration all weekend long. What can we expect from this? Is this going to go sort of a normal kind of inauguration as we've seen in the past?
I think that you want to draw a sharp distinction between protesting who the person is who's taking office and his policies or likely policies on the one hand and the legitimacy of a peaceful transfer of power. And I feel like we've had some rocky transfers beginning with Bush Gore. The one with Obama was very easy, and the only person who really challenged the legitimacy was Trump himself all the statements about where, you know, what goes around comes around. But it is a very dangerous thing in a democracy, a very deeply divided democracy as we are. To have people saying that he is not a legitimate president because just like when Harry Reid blew up the old 60-vote rule in the Senate, and people said, this is a mistake because you are not always going to be in the majority, and the Charles Schumer is going to have to live with the consequences of that now. People who are saying this is not legitimate, there will come a Democratic president, and it would be an awful thing.
But this is is not just sort of on a whim. I mean, you're hearing critics talk about, you know, when we have intelligence reports about other countries interfering in the election. I mean, I think you'll see the Trump camp all come back to, well, we won fair and square, or we won because, you know, no voting machines were hacked. But I think it's a larger idea of the forces that were at play, whether it be a foreign nation or our own FBI, as we see, that are getting in the way of the other side, Democrats in this case, sort of accepting the result.
Well, we'll never know the extent to which Russia's meddling affected an outcome. We'll just never know. And I think for some people, that's hard to swallow. I think for others, and an increasing number of Democrats, it's a reality that this man will be our president on Friday. And for all of the people who are now saying they're not going to attend, just on my way to the studio, I saw another congressman said he's not going either. I mean, the numbers are growing. And so I think what a lot of people will be both seeing and thinking about on Friday is the distinction between the celebratory aspect of this peaceful transition of power and the somber aspect of it. And the somber part is the ritualistic piece, the hand on the Bible and the oath. The celebratory part, I think, is fair for people to be turned off by that. It is fair.
Now, let's talk about, because there's been a lot of protests and plans since the day after election, especially when it comes to the Women's March, which we've heard so much about happening not only here in Washington, D.C., or in Washington, but here in Chicago, other places. This has been a part of the election storyline that has almost been ignored. The idea of Donald Trump winning the election and in the same time in his campaign offending women essentially 100% across
daily.
The board daily. But the idea that this is not been a storyline that has come up in the last 2 or 3 months. Do they have will people come out in numbers to sort of grab the attention that women in this country are still angry about the results, not just the results, but the way that this campaign was held?
It's extraordinary just how many people are committing to participate, whether it's in Washington, where you've got busloads and Amtrak trains and people who are, you know, actually flying out there from here and elsewhere. There are any number of people that I know in Washington who would have liked to have left town for inauguration, but they're stuck there now because they have so many friends coming into town. People are on couches and floors, and there's so many people committing to going. But you're right, Justin, that around the country, it's fascinating. It's going to be really a story to see what happens here in Chicago. And of course, globally, every day there's additional countries who are going to have some event of some kind. And the enormity of this is made all the more interesting by its origin, which was just a energized social media aspect. This was not a product of national organizations and a big strategy. This was a very clear ground up.
I think that protest marches are just fine, and this has got I know a lot of people who are going to be in them and so forth. Again, I think that the distinction I'd like to draw is between people who are concerned about him, concerned about his policies, concerned about things he has done, and people who say this is an illegitimate transfer of power. I guess I would like to ask you a question.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask you a question. I just saw today that a pro-life group, which had been listed among the groups that would be marching, has been been tossed out of the march. They won't be allowed to march.
I think that's actually ongoing. I don't know that there's a resolution quite yet, but it's a distinction between the protest march element and women who are wanting to assert principles and progressive values and beliefs, and they want to include as many people and as many voices as possible.
Consistent with their beliefs,
but not people who
disagree with them.
It's so important to remember that this is not a product of a Washington, D.C., you know, women's organization right. strategy.
This is not
this
sponsored
is ground
by the DNC.
Up. This is a really important set
That's
of voices.
That's right. But what it echoes, it seems to me, is something that we've seen a lot on college campuses, is that once you know that you're doing social justice, you have a right to tell other people to be quiet. And I think it's an interesting issue, and I'm not talking about my substantive views on this. I'm just asking about inclusiveness, because we've just seen a lot of exclusiveness.
Well, and inclusiveness is not easy.
There you go. Tracy Seffel, Charles Lipson in studio. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back with more Touche here on The Download. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
All right, Touche continues. Professor Charles Lipson, Tracy Seffel in studio tonight, and for Dave and Chris. Okay, so I am fascinated. The story that grabbed me this weekend, I mean, there was a lot. The Saturday and Sunday, the Congressman Lewis Twitter storm was crazy. But the interview that Donald Trump did for a German newspaper where he essentially said that NATO was obsolete has garnered a lot of, obviously, a lot of attention all the way up to Merkel. I mean, everybody really getting into the conversation of what Donald Trump's international stance is when it comes to his allies and what happens in Europe. Charles, is it reason for concern for NATO allies that he's talking like this to a foreign newspaper?
As Gabby Hayes used to say, darn tootin'. this is really a source of great concern. The Atlantic Alliance is the core of the United States' international commitments. It's taken 50-plus years to build. There is a problem. It actually should be bringing NATO closer together, the fact that that Russia is beginning to act in such an aggressive way normally would bring them to rely more on the U.S. But here's the problem. There are really two problems I want to call your attention to. The first is that when you're such a big, powerful country with such a big interest there, it's hard to get the smaller ones to pay their fair share. So one of the ways you might get them to pay is to threaten that you won't protect them unless you pull out.
Which he's done that.
But in doing that, you actually, to make the threat credible, you actually have to shake the alliance to its core. That's bad. The second thing that people should be aware of is that a world order was built up in the late 1940s. It continued through the fall of the Soviet Union. After the Soviet Union fell, there was a kind of an agreement that all nations participated in. And what you've seen over the past 10 years is two big challenges to that, and maybe more. But one is from Russia. And what they've said is, in effect, the idea that Europe had a stable territorial boundaries that could not be changed by force is not something we agree with. We will challenge that. And China is challenging in the Far East. You have Iran challenging
Isn't
in
that
the
just
Middle
part,
East.
It feels like that's part of the course every single year that
exactly.
these countries like to challenge.
But
and we gotta
what
be ready
I think
to...
you're getting now is pushback from the Americans. And what the Americans under Trump are in effect saying is, we want to act in a tougher way, but two things. We want our allies to pay their share, and we don't want to stick around for long, costly military engagements in the Middle East and elsewhere.
Hmm. It's interesting. I mean, with Tracy, as a layman, as someone who does not really understand much about international politics, that's why I have Professor Lipson on.
Classes in session.
But when you have the last couple of weeks where it's just been everything Russian, and the idea that Russia has been involved in some way in intelligence reports, wants to let everybody know that there's these rumors that they have a dossier on Trump. Does that start to sort of erode the trust when you hear stories about, well, maybe NATO should be obsolete when you're talking about Russia? Do you start to question whether or not Trump is being on the up and up?
That is a very unintentionally funny question. Sorry, Justin, but you're presuming that there was a baseline of trust to begin with, and I'm not sure there ever has been. I mean, he's parroting Putin talking points in what he's saying about NATO. You could match them up side by side and see that. I believe for the Republican Party and the Republican establishment and these people that he has put around him, from Bannon to Priebus to Pence, they have an obligation to stand up and say, you're crazy pants. This is not going to happen. And we're going to dial things back and be the sort of, you know, you can still be a militaristic hawk Republican type person, but you cannot rock the world order in the way that he seems to so frivolously do with his tweets.
Is there a faction in the Republican Party that wants to rock the world order? I mean, is he representing an area when he says that NATO's obsolete?
I don't think so. I think that Tillerson and Mattis really did, in fact, push back pretty hard on that. I thought what he said about Putin and about Merkel was a bit misinterpreted. At least the way I interpreted it, was he's going to start off with friendly relations, and he's a really transactional guy. If they live up to what he's expecting, good. And if not, then he'll turn on a dime. And in fact, what he said in the press conference about Putin was, I want to have a good relationship. I hope we can have a good relationship, but it'll depend on what kind of actions he takes. I think within the Republican Party, there is a faction that, and it's traditionally been the Midwest, that does not want to see very long-term overseas engagement that's costly, unending, and so forth. But I just don't know. I don't think he's responding to that. I think that's his view.
Tracy, let me turn to the cabinet nominees. We've seen all the confirmation hearings in the last the couple days here, last week leading into today. A myriad of, I guess, you know, successes. You had some that were, okay, this is going to – and then some were like, oh, I don't know, like Marco Rubio and Rex Tillerson and even Price today. There were some that didn't go well. And talk about – I mean, what do you think of this cabinet and how it's being put together? From a Democratic side, I mean, is this the kind of stuff that you expected from a Trump, or is this something more?
Well, as a Democrat, as a former staff person for the National Party, I know that many Democrats believe you have an obligation to – be opposed to all of these people for any number of reasons. You know, there's an entire war room in DC right now dedicated to just getting out the facts about these nominees, particularly the bad facts. But I believe, and this is a contrarian view among Democrats, that we're wasting our time to really go full-throated protests on each and every nominee. I believe that we should be, you know, really training our sights on whether it's a Tillerson. You know, there are certainly there's an A-list of people that I think are worthy of sincere and engaged opposition. But Democrats, we can't win. Even if we are opposed to all of these nominees, they're going to be confirmed. That is the mathematics of this all. Mm-hmm. So I say, let's put a little strategy behind this, because we've got a long way to go.
Tracy's very smart on this. I think that's exactly right. I've been writing about it, that I think they're just throwing things at the wall to see what sticks. But you can certainly see why they're going to be opposed to Sessions. The African-American community and civil rights issues are vital. Certainly, you can today, Martin Luther King Day, it's especially on our minds, and it's a huge constituency. The environmentalists are all going to be opposed to Scott Pruitt at EPA. That's a vital Democratic constituency. Betsy DeVos at the Department of Education really backs school choice, charters, privatization.
Everything but public.
And so these are absolute core issues for Democrats and core constituencies. Those they will go to the mat on. And I think that the issue with Tom Price is vital because a lot of women's reproductive health issues as well as insurance issues come up.
Okay, we only have a couple moments. Let's change to the happy, warm, fuzzy part. Barack Obama hosts the Chicago Cubs. Tracy, you're a huge Cubs fan. Talk about what it meant to see those two forces together at the White House today.
Oh, it was so fantastic. And even Obama as a Sox fan, you could tell he was kind of into it today. I was so proud of the team and the field staff and the front office. And they all just looked sort of young and nervous and adorable. And I loved every minute of it. I loved most of all the way that the president brought sports and politics back together. And I think a lot of people need to hear something like that this week, this very strange week that we're in. It was glorious.
Well, boy, this city really came together around the great Cubs team. And it looks like, you know, it didn't look like a fluke. It looks like a team that's built to last. And it was just wonderful to see them there in the White House. But presidency has, in addition to a political dimension, has a kind of king or queen dimension. And this was like you're visiting Buckingham Palace.
Yeah.
And I love those parts of it. I thought that it's one of the things that President Obama did the best.
Yeah, he did.
Throughout his presidency, so time after time, he represented the best elements of how we want to see ourselves.
Yeah. Dignified. And let's remember these comments, Professor, because I think down the road we will have a contrast.
A different kind of thing.
Yes.
That's where we got to leave it. Tracy Seffel, Professor Charles Lipson, thanks so much for being here, you guys, and subbing in for Touche. We'll have you guys on the program soon. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, Darcia Townsend is going to join us, a great food and drink reporter here in Chicago. We'll talk about the trends in 2017. Also, Margaret Hicks, who runs the walking tours Chicago Elevated. Great story where she spent 7 days living in the Pedway to get a better understanding and to sort of unearth the mysteries of that famed underground area of downtown Chicago. So she just came up for air today, and she's going to give us a little debrief tonight on the download coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Also, Jason Narduzzi, great musician, and his band Split Single. Jason also plays with bands like Bob Mould, Superchunk. He's toured Liz Phair, other places. So Jason in studio performing live tonight, Studio 435. But tonight, my guests at the big table have been fighting for equality for about a half a century, if not longer. Fred and Mike Klonsky have been active members of Chicago's progressive political community, as well as taking part in the protest movement here in Chicago. Both are active in advocating for better schools, as Fred is a former teacher and a former local teachers union president. Mike's a former secretary for the Students for a Democratic Society, the famed student group at the heart of the anti-Vietnam protests back in the late 60s. Today, they're both prolific writers, both blogging daily, and it is my pleasure to welcome both to the download, the brothers together, Fred and Mike Klonsky, here on the download. Good to see you guys. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us. Thanks for having us, Justin.
You know, it's great. I'm trying to get you guys on the show. I think it's apropos we're talking here on Martin Luther King Day. Talk about this holiday for you guys, both of you that spent time in you know, the civil rights movement, trying to sort of advocate and protest against the powers of peace. Talk about it. Mike, what's it mean to you? What does Martin Luther King Day mean to you?
Well, one of the things that stands out to me about Dr. King is after he died, the media and the powers that be had tried to turn him into kind of like a harmless icon. But to me, Dr. King was a revolutionary figure. And the thing that I really loved about him was that he, when he was asked about different politicians, who he supported. And his response was always the same. No matter who was elected, which party, his place would be out in the streets with the people. And, you know, that's what kind of inspired me. I came here, I moved to Chicago in 1968, the year that Chicago was in great turmoil,
yeah, right.
And about a few weeks after Dr. King was assassinated. And my wife and I packed up all our belongings and came from Los Angeles because I was elected to be the National Secretary of SDS, and our national headquarters was here on Madison Street. And I remember pulling into our new digs, our staff apartment on West Warren in 1968, and there were National Guard troops everywhere, tanks rolling up Madison Street, barbed wire, and we would sit up on the roof of the SDS office and watch the West Side burning in flames. And you know, this was the power of Dr. King and the anger people felt
when
he was assassinated.
Fred?
Well, you know, I was on the internet today, and I was kind of stunned that when I saw a tweet from the Federal Bureau of Investigation honoring Martin Luther King on the anniversary of his birth, and because I remember when the FBI didn't exactly have a close personal relationship with Dr. King, except in the sense that they spied on him, bugged his phone calls, listened in on his bedroom conversations with his wife. The director of the FBI, Herbert Hoover, identified him as the most dangerous Negro in America.
J. Edgar Hoover,
And tried to get him to kill himself, I think, is what came out in the COINTELPRO stuff. So this idea, it's gotten to the point where he's been turned into this this kind of plastic saint, like you would put on the dashboard of your car when I was a young kid.
Almost respectability, like this idea, and I read a story about that today, that the Black Lives Matter movement right now is a little bit perturbed at the, if that's the word I'd use, but that they are, you know, sort of, why can't you be more like the Dr. King movement? You know, and there is a little bit of head scratching when it comes to revisionist history, history books are written. Yeah.
Yes. And so, We like the radical Dr. King, and that's what he really was. He was a radical. He would say time and time again that if peace means we have to live as second class citizens, if peace means live under segregation, then I don't want any part of it.
Why do you think that his legacy or even the memory of Dr. King has changed over time? Why do you think, when you talk about that sort of, you know, the plasticizing or the idea of like almost cleaning up his image, where does that come from?
That's the power of this system. I mean, this is a powerful system with great ideological hold on people. And, you know, in this country, we're fortunate that the government doesn't rule by naked force all the time. You know, it also rules by the ideological hold it has on us, and it has the power to reframe images and conversations and how we look at people. And that's what I mean.
It's also about how, you know, who gets to tell the story, who gets to tell history, and who gets to tell the story. So if we were talking to a young woman today, and we were mentioning that that my brother was National Secretary of Students for a Democratic Society, and she looked at us kind of blankly. I said, "Well, this was the largest anti-war student organization in the history
People
of the United States.
Yeah.
Hundreds of thousands of members and campuses all across the country. But who knows this story? Who knows this story today? Who gets to tell that the story of what happened in 1968 or in 1963?" So, part of the way the system works is to get control of the narrative and get control of who tells the story.
I'll give you another example like that. I used to work over at Paul Robeson High School on the South Side. And do you know who Paul Robeson?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would ask my graduate students at DePaul every year when they would come in, do you know who Paul Robeson was? And only about two or three of them knew. But all the young kids at the high school students at Robeson High School all knew.
It is interesting, the history or who's telling the history.
So I would ask them, I would say, well, now, what if that question was on the standardized test that determined who graduated, who got to college, and how many of you would be here right now, and how many of those kids who don't ever get in here would make the cut? You
know? Mike Klonsky, Fred Klonsky, the Klonsky brothers, can I call you that?
Sure. That's okay. That's brothers Klonsky, like Karamazov.
There you go. In studio tonight, The Big Table, let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk a little bit about that history, talk about the SDS, but also talk about education, because this is a big part of what you guys fight for. And you guys have seen through both of your eyes just the way that you know, or education has progressed or not progressed over a significant amount of time here in Chicago. Again, Fred and Mike Klonsky in studio with my guests at the big table. Stay with us. Seems like appropriate music for you guys. Like it feels.
I have my hearing aids on, but I can't hear what it is.
Fred and Mike Klonsky in studio. They're my guests tonight at the big table, longtime activists and advocates. Fred was a longtime teacher, also an organizer, a union president.
That's right.
Teachers union president. Also, Mike was the national secretary for the Students for Democratic Society, the SDS, which was a huge student anti-war organization back in the 60s and you know, I mean, 70s too. I mean, it's tremendous to be able to look back and, you know, just putting your guys in the old internet machine, you know, Mike, and being able to see you with your long hair and your little mustache and, you know, sitting next to, you know, Fred Hampton or Bobby Rush and the Black Panthers. I mean, talk about, I mean, what
I don't think I've changed at all. Do you?
I don't think you've changed. No. I'm just getting to know you here. But I mean, talk about where'd you get your love of politics? Where was it that you started to pay attention to the world around you?
I don't really call it a love of politics. I mean, I guess a part of it is DNA. You know, our parents were radicals. Our dad, when he was a teenager, hitched a ride over to France and hiked across the Pyrenees and was one of the volunteers in the Spanish Civil War, fought against the fascists and Franco in 1936, you know, and came back. It was a lifelong radical revolutionary, and was persecuted very severely during the McCarthy period in the 50s. And so I kind of had a hate relationship with politics growing up because my dad was persecuted, and our family went through very tough times at that time. But the 60s got me, you know, and it wasn't just politics. It was the culture.
Right.
It was, and even the late 50s, you know, the Beat Generation and the music and the culture. It was really the 60s student movement that got me, and especially being able to, you know, when we would turn on the TV in the morning for the first time, we got to see these napalm bombs exploding in Vietnam and villages being destroyed. And then right after that news came images of from Mississippi of the police turning dogs and fire hoses on Black folks who were protesting for their rights. And, you know, just being a, not so much a political person, but just being a caring individual, I tried to be, got my blood boiling. And then next thing I knew, I was getting arrested at protests and things like that. And police kind of beat a lot of that into me. So I wouldn't call it a love relationship exactly, but I've been stuck with it ever since.
How about you, Fred?
Well, you know, I'm much younger than my older brother. And so a lot of my memories of the McCarthy period and what happened to our father, not as strong, you know, I don't really have those same memories. So for me, I got involved late, really in high school, in L.A. at the time. Although 10 years earlier, the U.S. Supreme Court had ruled that school segregation was illegal, that separate but equal schools were illegal. In fact, the Los Angeles School District then, and probably still is a highly segregated school system. And so one of the first things that I was active in was I went to a predominantly white Jewish high school in Hollywood, Fairfax High School, mostly kids of immigrants from Europe, Jewish kids from whose parents had fled Europe, often before the war and some after.
Yeah.
The Congress of Racial Equality was organizing what they called a study in at the LA Board of Education. And we would organize, impacted us a lot because the system in LA was segregated not like it was in the South, but because the LA School Board had drawn district lines that ensured that some schools would be all white and others would be all Black or Chicano, and
Like Chicago.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, that sounds very familiar, not, right?
Things have, this is what's interesting about the current period to me, is that as terrible as I think, well, as I know, I think the election of Donald Trump is, we've been here before. We've seen this this kind of stuff that that tries to turn white and black working people against each other. We've been here before, and beat it before. I was talking to Michael, and my memory is terrible. So there's a reporter for the New York Times who's done a study. She calls herself the segregation reporter, and I'll pull up her name for you later. But her point is, in doing the study, is that no single thing impacts the success of poor and non-white students of color more been successful than segregate than integrating the public schools, that's in fact the only thing that has improved the performance, the quality of education for poor and
we've seen institutions and governments go out of their way
they've tried charters, and none of it has worked. The only thing that has worked, and according to these studies, is what we tried to do back at Fairfax High School in 1964, was to redraw the lines so that the schools wouldn't be segregated. And what the studies have shown is that up until about Brown versus Board of Education, that up until about 1988, when Reagan ran on his Southern strategy and promised Northern and Southern politicians that they wouldn't have to worry about DSEG orders or attempts by the federal government to integrate the schools, that scores rose for students of color up to 1988. And once segregation began to be reinforced, that those scores decline.
Segregation plays a huge role in Chicago. Mike, I mean, when you take us back to the late 60s, I mean, that was a big part of the inequality and what we saw here in the city of Chicago. And a lot of what was happening with, you know, when you're, it's like you said, you're sitting on the rooftops watching the West Side burn. You know, it hasn't changed since the days that you were out sort of fighting, not only, you know, in 1968, but 1969, Days of Rage.
Well, part of the reason the cities were burning, not just Chicago, was over 40 cities in flames after Dr. King was assassinated, had a lot to do with the failure of integration. The beating down of the civil rights movement and disempowerment of African American people here in the northern cities like Chicago, and the tone of the civil rights movement changed from being one of integration to what they call black power. You know, black people saying, well, if you're not going to integrate, we want to have control of our own communities and our own schools. And in 1968, for example, there was big struggles around what was called community control, not just of the schools, but of the police department and of other institutions in the city. And a much more militant leadership arose that replaced Dr. King, that was not nonviolent by any stretch.
This would be the Black Panthers,
the Black Panther Party, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which is kind of ironic. It started out Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, but after King's assassination, it was no longer students. It wasn't nonviolent, and it also wasn't very well coordinated. But that's a joke, you know. but the my point.
I got it.
My point is that. Again, the point I tried to make earlier, we have a slogan, no justice, no peace, you know. So the failure of integration also meant that there was much more discontent, and people weren't willing to live in the old way anymore. And I think what people are really worried about is with the new Trump administration is that there's going to be more civil disorder.
Well, let's get to that. Well, let's take a break here so we can get an update on tonight's news. And there's a lot to talk about. Mike and Fred Klonsky in studio, both longtime members of the activist progressive political movement here in Chicago, protest movement, former teacher, former treasurer, or secretary for the Students for Democratic Society, national secretary. We'll have more with brothers Klonsky here on the show at the big table after the news. Stay with us. Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guests tonight at the big table, Fred and Mike Klonsky, longtime educators, activists, advocates, all the way along. I mean, we're talking everything from, you know, MLK Day, Martin Luther King, to Chicago in the late 60s, to segregation, to education. We're going to talk more about that coming up here. It is interesting. I mean, we a lot of emphasis on the inauguration, a lot of emphasis on protest. And almost, you know, under this guise that it's uncharted territory, we don't know what's going to happen. But you know what? I mean, listening to your stories, listening to the first half of this interview, it does feel like we've been here before.
Yeah, you know, a lot of the young activists who I know, because of my kids, basically, are bewildered. We're thrown for a loop when Trump got elected. It was like their world was coming apart, and they didn't know how to respond. And, you know, because there's such a disconnect between this generation and us and the older generation. But we're very familiar with this, with these kind of threats, you know, with the racist underbelly of this country.
Right, sure.
This is not a shock to us, you know, when you hear the president talking about, well, this is my black guy over here, or talking about Mexicans being criminals or mm-hmm. rapists. You know, I remember when Lyndon Johnson would talk about Dr. King as that N-word preacher. See, that's how he described him. And so, we've been around long enough to remember and to know, and to also know how to resist it. You know, and we resisted it during the, you know, going all the way back to the 50s and 60s. The 50s was a lot of persecution. People hounded by McCarthy, put into prison, lost their jobs. A lot of everybody from writers to actors couldn't work anymore. Then in the 60s, right here in Chicago, you know, you had political assassinations. Fred Hampton shot and murdered in his bed right up here on the west side of Chicago. A lot of very serious repression, something that was called Operation COINTELPRO that was launched by the Federal Bureau of Investigation to harass people who were in the anti-war movement and the protest movement. And we built the resistance movement then. And now we're going to do it again. And you can see people know how to do it. There's going to be a big march, a women's march at the inauguration in protest of, you know, Trump's assault on women's rights and, you know, the kind of culture that he's trying to push. I won't get into the sort of details. Everybody knows
about that.
So, yeah, we're familiar with oppression and resistance, and we're on familiar ground here.
Fred, for you, as an educator, longtime teacher, I mean, when you have a background like this, when you talk about you know, the idea of being an advocate or being even involved in politics, or you know, in progressive politics, Harold Washington all the way down, mm-hmm. you know, do the students that you've seen over your time as a, you know, you're retired now, but as a teacher, I mean, are they aware of the protest movements that have come before?
No, I know because they're not. Where are they going to learn them from? The notion of a curriculum that's taught in the classroom that evolves out of teachers' own experience. I mean, there are thousands of teachers who have the same kind of experience and background as my brother and I do, who want to and have to defy the rules in order to tell that story. Instead, what they're expected to do is be like someone who is serving up a Big Mac at McDonald's and deliver what they call the Common Core curriculum, meaning predetermined facts where everybody's supposed to be on the same page on the same day, and where we measure success by a set of standardized tests. So in order to do anything different, teachers essentially have to break the rules and teach from their own experience, from their own lives. Like I say, many of them African American teachers, Latino teachers, and progressive white teachers who went through these experiences will get in trouble. Imagine getting trouble if they teach a a curriculum that's based on the things that they care about and know about and have experienced themselves. When I was a young student, a teacher who could come into the classroom and say, I traveled here, I did that, here are the stories that I can tell you from my own rich experiences. The students love those experiences. And instead, today, classrooms are being – and when I go back to my friends, which I do now, I taught for 30 years up in Park Ridge, union president up there for 10. When I go back to my and have lunch with my friends, as I do because I'm retired now and can spend lunches doing things like that, but they talk about that, how significantly the atmosphere in classrooms has changed because not over salary issues or which are important, but over the thing that they came to teaching to do.
Where does that come from?
Let me give you an example, Justin. Today, and I got this from the Arizona Republic. Today in Arizona, two congressmen, Thorpe and Fincham, introduced House Bill 2120 that prohibits schools and colleges receiving state monies from teaching, quote, social justice or anything that would lead to, quote, division among the races or ethnic groups. So they're passing a law in Arizona that bans teachers from teaching the word social justice or mentioning anything about social justice. I mean,
I mean, is it out of fear? Is it out of the idea that people will see the stories of their history and talk about the civil rights movement? I mean, even you see the stories of it's so isolated, but a small town in Mississippi changing it's not MLK Day, it's America Day or whatever.
Sure.
But
yeah.
I mean, are we seeing a fear of telling the stories of social justice because that might mean that the people will have the confidence to overturn government?
It's just like we were talking about how the image of Dr. King has changed. There's a cultural war in this country over how to interpret its history. And it has a lot to do with this ideological hold that they have on people. Yes, it's kind of like rebellion insurance. You know, this country was born in rebellion, you know, but there is fear. There's fear of civil disorder as conditions get worse for people. There's fear of uprising, a revolt, of social change.
Look, when I came to Chicago I moved from Los Angeles here in 1973. And when I came to Chicago in 73, it didn't look like Chicago looks today. Every neighborhood, and I don't mean to make it look like it was paradise, but every neighborhood had a neighborhood public school, a church or some other place of worship, a bar, and a factory. When I first came to Chicago, I got a job not far from where I live in Logan Square now at Stuart Warner up on Diversity and Levitt. But this is typical. Neighborhoods all over the city.
The building block, the foundation of a neighborhood.
It was the industrial base, in fact, that brought hundreds of thousands of African Americans to this city for jobs from the South. And those jobs became, because of struggle, became union jobs, paying union wages. Later, I got a job down at U.S. Steel. I had no, being a 60s guy, I dropped out of college in those days, and so I had no marketable skills whatsoever. But I could go down, like hundreds of thousands of other young people could do, go down to Southworks or Republic Steel or places like that and get a job that paid a union wage, that paid their health insurance. And in those days, that was just when the skilled jobs were opening up to African American workers and to women. Our union president down at Southworks was the first woman to be the president of a basic steel local anywhere in the United States. So that's what, in there's plenty of other things about Chicago that we could talk about, but those things were true, and those things aren't true anymore. We don't have neighborhoods public schools. There are areas of the west side of Humboldt Park where 4 square miles of the city doesn't have a single neighborhood public elementary school, where the factories are gone. There's been a deindustrialization. African-American workers who worked in those jobs are gone, left the city entirely, almost 250,000 African Americans gone over the last 20 years, left not just the city, but the entire region. And so this creates what my brother was talking about. Yes, it's a question of fear, because if you don't know the history of the city and you don't know the history of struggle that made it look like that, then then you don't know your own history.
Let me ask you, I guess the simple question, I guess the best way to kind of end this conversation is just about, do you feel that when it comes to social justice, when it comes to some of the issues that you've been advocating for since the late 60s, or as you mentioned, the 50s, has society gotten better? I mean, have some of these issues that you've been fighting for, have you had victories? Have you seen change?
Yes, of course. Of course. Otherwise, I would just be in despair, you know. But yes, we've had, I thought, I was proud to be part of the civil rights movement, you know, and the great victories we won for voting rights and equal housing and public schools. I mean, I've been proud to play a small part in that progress. But what you have now is a rollback of all those gains that we made, all those victories that people gave their sweat, blood, and life for. You know, I'll give you one example. I heard Vice President-elect Pence today defending Trump against his vicious attack on John Lewis, you know, one of my heroes. But of course, he didn't just attack John Lewis. He first praised him in order to attack him. And he said, you know, how could a guy who led the fight for the voting rights bill, you know, say these bad things about the election being rigged and things like that, being illegitimate. And I thought, why is this guy praising the voting rights bill? In 2 years ago, the conservative Supreme Court gutted it, gutted the voting rights bill. And if you want to talk about the reasons Trump won this election, I think the gutting of the voting rights bill and depriving so many people of their right to vote out in the states was one of the main reasons for much more so than the Russian, spy thing.
It's just interesting because I guess it says something as we honor Martin Luther King and Martin Luther King Day here in Chicago. A lot of the social issues around social justice and things that you guys have been fighting for your entire life, they're never permanent. Meaning there are this ebb and flow. There's a rollback, or there might be a Supreme Court, a judge that strikes it down, or a movement that changes it. I mean, for you guys, both who have spent your lives, you know, sort of really, you know, looking out for these issues of social justice, how does it feel that the fight is continuing?
Well, we were talking, you know, I heard President Obama constantly, really, in the last, I guess he's worried about something, about peaceful transition, that the thing about that's important to remember is that in this country, we've always had a history of peaceful transition. And in fact, at least in my lifetime, there's never been a peaceful transition of power.
That's true,
In Washington, whether it was when Reagan got elected, or before that, when
we heard Bill
Nixon got elected.
Talking about Nixon,
yes, thousands protested Richard Nixon in Washington at his inauguration in Washington. Hundreds were arrested. True about Reagan as well, and Bush. We were in Washington at the beginning of the Bush administration where there were millions of people around the world protesting his preparedness for a war in Iraq. So the transition of power in this country has never been peaceful in the sense that there hasn't been resistance to the policies that have tried to do what we've talked about tonight. So part of having that kind of perspective means that when hundreds of thousands of people are marching in Washington on Saturday, it'll be a continuation of the way things have always been.
Look, we helped. I think we helped end the war in Vietnam. I mean, that was a great victory. You know, but you know, we had in the civil rights movement, we had a slogan: "Freedom is a constant struggle." So there's like never one struggle you win, and then you say, "Okay, well, we can all go home now." Unfortunately, when President Obama was elected, a lot of people thought that was it. You know, this is the post-racial era, and all this stuff is behind us now. We can go home and go to sleep. And the anti-war movement, for example, folded up tent and went home for 8 years. But now we see that, you know, if you don't protect the gains that you won, they're going to get rolled back.
Mike Klonsky, Fred Klonsky, longtime educators, activists, advocates here in Chicago, the brothers Klonsky, as we've now. That's good. I can't thank you guys enough for taking some time out tonight to talk to us, especially on Martin Luther King Day. Both of you guys have been a part of the civil rights movement and about bringing equality here to the city of Chicago and the issues that we have here in the city. I appreciate it. And thank you so much for being my guest tonight.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
Good to have the brothers Klonsky in studio. I don't know much about that. You know, I've always known the names, you know, and Joanna Klonsky as well as a longtime, I guess, publicist in town as well. She was in the 40 Under 40 and Cranes. But, you know, I've never today it was interesting to go into some of the stories. We didn't even get into it because we just sort of, you know, we're having a freewheeling conversation. But, you know, Mike played a big part in the Days of Rage here in Chicago in 1969 in a really interesting sort of broke ranks with the Bill Ayers and the Bernadine Dorns, as we know as the Weather Underground. That's when they sort of became more of a revolutionary or just sort of a rogue kind of group. That's when Mike got out. It's interesting. Yeah, but we didn't get a chance, so we'll have to do part two. I feel like by the end of my time in Chicago, I need to get like 10 parts in on the Brothers Klonsky story. Don't you think, Pete? Wouldn't you be like, you know, that was part one. We need 9 more parts. But good to have them talking about Martin Luther King. It's interesting. You know, I agree. Like, there's something interesting about the way that you listen to these guys talk about, Mike talk about Martin Luther King, you know, Dr. King and what he meant or what, you know, in current or to talk about and even knowing in the present day movement, as opposed to how it's sort of been cleaned and desensitized and sort of presented on mattress commercials as we know today. But it is, I mean, I saw the story today, which I thought was really interesting, that there was a lot of pushback on from people, social media, other places, saying to the Black Lives Matter movement, why don't you be more like Dr. King? And I think there's something there. I don't know the, you know, and you listen to stories of people who were there to talk about, you know, the assassination of Dr. King and how cities, major cities in this country burned, you know, 40 plus riots. So the idea that you have a Black Lives Matter movement in hundreds marching peacefully on Michigan Avenue, be careful what you wish for when you say, like, you know, wouldn't you be more like Dr. King? I feel like they may not be understanding the history and may be sort of reading the revisionist history books when it comes to the protest movements of this country, especially when it comes to race. So those, good to have the Klonsky brothers in. All right, coming up, Adarsha Townsend's going to be in. We'll talk food. Also, Margaret Hicks and her 7-day excursion, Living in the Pedway. It's coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman here on the beautiful Michigan Avenue. Coming up in the 10 o'clock hour, Jason Narduzzi, split single, live in Studio 435 with some live music tonight. Jason and his band. Jason, longtime Chicago musician, actually lives in Evanston, but he also tours with Bob Mould and Superchunk. So many bands. He's a rock star, and he's got very sexy elbows. So, that's all I know. So we'll talk to Jace. He's been on the show before, but this will be the first time he's performing. So that's coming up. Studio 435 tonight. All right, let's make a transition. Talk about something that's very near and dear to my heart, and that's food. Of course. 2017 is upon us, and it is sort of the winter blahs time. We're past the holidays, you know, and I guess we have Valentine's Day coming up. But, you know, this is the time of the year where you really want to get out on a Saturday and go try a new restaurant or go to one of your old favorites. This is, you know, we've got restaurant week coming up here, and what better way to do that than to sort of preview what 2017 has in store for us in studio. This is exciting. Adarsha Townsend, she's been on the show before, but we've done it by phone. She's a food and drink expert, also the editor at GoChicago.about.com. Adasha, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Good to see you too, Justin. Haven't seen you in a while.
I know. It's great. It's always fun to have you in the studio.
Thank you. All right.
So let's talk about 20. I know it doesn't really work this way in the sense that, you know, food continues, especially the restaurant industry. But if you were going to think about a trend to sort of forecast for 2017 when it comes to restaurants and food, what would it be?
I would say one of the biggest trends is vegetables, and not saying that everybody's going to become a vegetarian, but I feel like vegetables are really becoming the star. You know, you look at places like Bad Hunter,
yeah.
You look at places like Honey's, you look at place that's also in the West Loop, you look at places like, Dos Urban Cantina, and they're using vegetables in a way that we've never seen before. They're grilling them, and they're just putting all these great sauces and seasons. I mean, they're really making them the
star.
And
it's not just for vegetarians.
I mean, I just went to Baptiste and Bottle, and I had Red Snapper, and the vegetables were like everywhere, and it was just like a nice sized portion of the fish, but the vegetables, the fennel, and just beautiful portions and just beautiful colors of vegetables, really big this year.
Sounds a lot like when I get out the old crock pot, you know, drop in the stew.
Lots
I can do
of
five or six different vegetables, just mm-hmm. how I roll, you know. Yeah, I saw this. I see the sign, the Bad Hunter sign, and I know it. So is that a straight up, that's a vegetarian? Are we seeing a trend in trying to go in that direction where we see restaurants that are totally devoted to meatless experience?
Well, Bad Hunter is not vegetarian.
Oh, it's not.
Again, it's vegetarian folk. I mean, it's vegetable focus, but they still have a lot of meat on the menu. It's just that they're, like I said, they're making the vegetable the star, and they're just really paying attention to it. The meat is kind of like the side. I know that sounds weird, but I mean, these presentations of the vegetables and the garnishes, which are all edible, they're just glorious and beautiful, and they're flavorful. You just want to eat them up, even if you're not a big vegetable person.
And that's a departure. I mean, if you think about, mm-hmm. you know, even here on Michigan Avenue, you got Purple Pig or what they've done for years at Publican now.
And all the steakhouses.
It's an emphasis on meat. I mean, that's really the go-to for Chicago. I mean, it's the meat and potatoes, right?
Yes.
So there we go. All right. So what, I mean, I'm thinking about, I mean, the Restaurant Week is coming up and mm-hmm. people are going to get an opportunity. When Restaurant Week is essentially an opportunity to sample a lot of different places for cheaper than it usually is, right?
Right. $33 for to $44 for three courses. Some people are throwing in a cocktail and a dessert, depending on the restaurant, especially the newer restaurants. But they're like 350 participants. It's January 27th through February 9th. And like you said, it's the dead of winter. It brings people into restaurants that they may not have gone to, or they may have forgotten about, or there's that restaurant that's kind of expensive. You want to try it out before you really try it out. This is a good way. This is a good way of doing it. And it's in Chicago and the suburbs. So, I mean, I love Restaurant Week for that reason. And there's so many new places like Eden and the West Loop District. I mean, the West District. West Lake District. It's like kind of like
Lake
a new
District.
Area.
All right. Where's that? Like Lake Street?
Yes, it's on Lake Street, and it's closer to Damon, and it's about 5 minutes away from United Center. But places like that, that's brand new. I know I just said vegetables are a huge star, but I really love this new place, Eden, which opened at the end of the year, because they have this braised duck lasagna on the menu, and it's just so different, and it's a huge portion of it. They have a lot of vegetables in it too, because they have mustard greens at the bottom. But that's again part of that trend I was telling you about.
Well, I mean, there's been so much in the city about the West Loop. I mean, this has been where mm-hmm. all the restaurants. I mean, you even see, you know, every single. It seems like every day there's a new place that's being torn down, and something else is coming up. Is that going to continue in 2017, where you see more restaurants go over there, or are there other pockets of the city that might sort of lay claim to a restaurant row?
It's going to continue to explode because Google, as you know, is over there, and there's going to be a couple of more hotels that come over there. When the McDonald's Corporation moves over there, where Harpo used to be. So not only is there an explosion of employees moving over there, but also a lot of residences. So we're going to see more and more. There are at least 8 new places within the next 6 months. We're going to see
Come
even
on,
more
it's a
places.
Big city.
Yes, it is a big city.
Spread out.
That's what I say. But at least all the concepts are different. Most of them are locally owned. There are not a lot of chain restaurants, which I'm seeing a lot of opening within the last 2 years. But that is a very hot area. But also Lincoln Square has been rocking hot right now, especially with like the Six that opened last year. They're expect, I think, a couple of new cocktail lounges. I've been hearing like some rumblings of that happening this year, as well as some other local restaurateurs, because like I've said before on some other shows, because the chefs don't live, most chefs and bartenders don't live downtown.
Yeah, right.
They live in real neighborhoods, and they want to start, you know, they want those kind of places that they can get downtown in their own neighborhoods. So you're starting to see more of those chefy influence restaurants and mixology bars in neighborhoods you've never seen before. So we're going to see a lot of that this
year. That's interesting, because, you know, and I would assume that the West Loop will run into a rent problem at some point where, like, I mean, all the buildings that are coming in there and all the places, if you want to start a restaurant, it's not going to be fiscally possible. You're going to have to find other places in the city to do it.
It is getting oversaturated. I agree.
So, all right, let's talk about, well, let's take a break. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. Adasha Townsend, in-studio food and drink expert, also the editor at gochicago.about.com. We'll continue the conversation, because I want to get into, you know, what can we expect from out, I mean, we do the food part, but also the drinks part. Like, is 2017 going to be another sort of frothy drink here?
Oh,
or are
no.
we talking wine? Like, what's it going to be? Craft beer? There's a lot going on in Chicago. We'll get to all of it here on The Download. Stay with us. It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Adasha Townsend in studio, food and drink expert, editor at gochicago.about.com. We're talking about 2017, the year in food. A little bit of drink, too. 2016 saw the end of some classic and famous restaurants in Chicago. Some restaurants got put to bed, which is a bummer.
Yeah, one of my favorite restaurants, which has been around for so long, I mean, before our parents were born, the Cape Cod Room and the Drake Hotel, that the last night for that place was December 31st. It was really sad to see it go.
Yeah.
I mean, classic seafood.
The joke I made was that's the place that you meet your new grandpa.
Oh.
You know, when grandma's got the new boy and then brings it around and you go to Cape Cod Room. That's, oh, these are great scallops. It's nice to meet you, Harry. That was Cape Cod Room for me. Anyway, other restaurants too, not just Cape Cod Room. That one got a lot of play. Like, I was surprised that, like, by New Year's, like, it felt like before the New Year's celebration shows took off, it was like 5-minute packages on the Cape Cod Room and the end of an era.
It truly was an end of an era, as was the Parthenon in Greektown. That was a whole sad closing. What happened there, wasn't it?
Yeah, and there was another Greek restaurant in that area that closed as well not too long ago. And you wonder about the strength of Greektown, because Greektown has the museum that's there, which is great and brand new. And also, you know, some you'll see some relics and some stores, but it's really based on those restaurants. You know, people know Greektown for those restaurants, and you don't want to see, there's still some amazing restaurants there, but you don't want to see restaurants close, because that really is, people know Greek. I mean, I would even say Chicagoans know Greektown more than the West Loop. I mean, if you say Greektown, everyone knows where that's at.
Exactly. Yeah. I agree.
So that was a big loss. Yeah.
There was also Rose Angelis. We talked about on the break. I mean, why are you laughing?
I'm laughing because that's a great restaurant. I like that. It was an Italian restaurant buried back at Wrightwood, or
yes.
One of those is back by DePaul in Lincoln Park, and it was the go-to first date, or I would say second date.
Second,
you had a good first date, and you're like, I'm going to step my game up a little bit for some creamy ravioli. I'm going to roll. But it was always packed. You'd go across the way, and you'd go to the bar, and they'd call you. It was kind of, I just remember, and it's funny because I turned to my wife, I was like, oh, that place is, I can't believe that place is closing. And I'm like, yeah, but I haven't been there in like 10 years, you know. I mean, I think it serves a purpose for every Chicagoan for a little bit.
Same thing with Vivo.
Vivo.
Remember Vivo?
Yeah.
I can't believe that one closed.
That closed? I didn't even know that closed.
That closed, I think it closed sometime in the summer.
You know, it's interesting because that restaurant was one of the original West Loop restaurants, that and Marché, there was Red Light. Red Light was
Red
right
Light.
Next door.
Those Showing
were
your
like,
age.
Those, yeah, right. But those were like the original West Loop restaurants, where when you said, "Oh, this is an actual restaurant row."
Mm-hmm.
Those, and you see little remnants and relics of that in the West Loop, but those are all Vivo's. One of the last ones.
That was
the
last.
A bummer.
That was the last one. Mm-hmm. Everything else is new.
Everything. Ugh.
And Salpicon.
Well, Salpicon's gone.
Mm-hmm. Salpicon closed about a month ago. Mexican restaurant.
Yeah.
Very traditional, very good restaurant in Old Town. It's been there almost 30 years.
Man, I got to pay attention to my old restaurants. I don't pay attention to these. There's going to be a time where I'm going to turn into my dad, who's just like, oh yeah, that's where I remember that restaurant. Where'd that restaurant go? Every time he comes to town, that's what he does. Oh. He says, oh, take a little dad. That used to be a Woolworths. I'm like, yeah, all right, dad. All right.
On the upside, though, yes, with these closings is that Arun's was scheduled to close, but then he decided that he's going to keep it open. The famous Thai restaurant.
Yep, on Irving and Kedzie?
I believe so.
Somewhere in that area.
Right, exactly. Right. But he decided to reconcept it, but, you know, keep kind of the general premise of it. But the fact that he's not closing is a really good thing.
They had the Arun's, he has another Thai restaurant that's part of the Thai Town experience that was being made up in that area. And it was on Check Please.
Yes.
And I was like, and they said it's a fan, whoever introduced it was Arun's. And I'm like, oh, this is going to be great. And the one guy who was like, man, I didn't really like it. And I'm like, what are you talking about? First off, you don't know anything about anything. I haven't even seen the restaurant. I just see the food. I'm like, get out of here. It's Arun. You're out. You're revoking your Chicago card that you did not like a project of Arun's anyway. Let's get past this sadness and talk about the openings. What are some of the things that might be coming to Chicago or have opened here in Chicago 2017?
Well, one of the big ones that's going to happen is the guys from Boca, who own Girl and a Goat and GT Fish and Oyster and Prime and Swift and Sons. They're opening. They haven't named the restaurant yet, but they are opening a new restaurant in the Viceroy Hotel in the Gold Coast. And that's going to open sometime in the late summer, but definitely expect a new concept from them. They haven't named the chef or anything like that, but they've been talking about that for about a year. But it is definitely set in stone. It was where the Cedar Hotel was, where that whole Melvin B's situation
used to be. How often does a group like Boca open a restaurant? Is it? I mean, it feels like every day they have two or three a year.
It used to be once a year. It seems like now it's that group and one-off hospitality, which owns Blackbird.
Yeah.
They're starting to open about one or two a year.
Wow. And are they venturing? Does Boca venture out of River North / we see them in the West Loop River North, and then they do hit Lincoln Park. But are we seeing any of those companies moving to Logan Square, moving Albany Park, like trying things on the outskirts of town?
I don't think so, because they have certain price points and they have a certain audience, and I think that's their comfort zone. They're going to stay in those areas, as well as the one-off hospitality guys, even though they have Wicker Park with Big Star and Violet Hour. I think maybe there's a possibility that I could see them doing something in Logan Square. I could definitely see that. Or someplace like Avondale. I could see them open a Big Star type place there. But the Boca guys, I can't see.
How about for Rogers Park, for Pete? Pete lives in Rogers Park. They never go up there.
I know. What's up with that?
Yeah, come on. Pete, you got to get some political clout.
I haven't seen any of the restaurant groups open up. I mean, that is some new territory that needs to be explored.
Yeah. Some competition for the old Hartman Cafe.
And there's money up there. There's lots of money up there. Evanston, right across the border. Yeah. You know, Alpena went up there to Evanston this year. Yeah. I mean, well, last year, so... some people are starting to move north, further north. Everything is in downtown.
Okay, so let's talk about, I mean, the other opening that I really enjoyed, I was mentioning in the break, I went to One Fun, which is Austin Baker's restaurant, the Chinese restaurant in the West Loop. I went there this weekend because he's going to be on the show next week. And it is so good. And he was the chef at Au Cheval.
Right.
Who launched Brendan Sodikoff's restaurant there. And then he went to Bar Marta in Humboldt Park to launch that great restaurant. And now he's at One Fun with this experience. But the best part is they have an upstairs bar. And this is a trend. Ardash, I'm confused. So the West Loop, I've known it for years.
Okay.
And there's been great restaurants. But there hasn't really been a party scene there. You know, there'll be restaurants and you'll have the Girl and the Goats where you're like, okay, but there's not dance clubs. And I mean, you go north, maybe Lake Street, like the more traditional sort of club. But not only do you go upstairs, they have a bar. They have a dim sum and a bar and they have karaoke and it's hopping. That's where you can tell, like, that's where people are going at night. And then I went to a rum bar, which is at, and I forgot the name of it. It's at Halstead and Randolph, just east.
Ronero?
Yeah, Ronero.
Yes.
And we went in there, and I was like, I just want to get a drink. I was like, oh, rum bar. I was like, I was in Vegas. Like, I'll have any kind of rum. And we went upstairs, and the place was jamming. Jumping. It was just shoulder to shoulder with people doing dance club stuff.
Right.
And I was like, this is like, it's almost like the River Northifying of the West Loop. Like, it's coming, it's moving west.
It's coming. There's also Booze Box, which is underneath Sushi Doku, which has been down there for a couple of years. There's Izakaza under the Momotaro. That's pretty jumping. And I just heard last week that Grange Burger Bar, they have an upstairs cocktail lounge. It's supposed to be jumping. It hasn't jumped off yet, but they're planning to get in on that action.
Everybody wants in on the jumping action.
Because they know that it's getting younger and younger over there. And, you know, after the restaurant scene, people want to hang out and stay in the River North West Loop area.
I felt so old.
So why not take advantage of that?
I felt so old.
So,
I was
it was a really young crowd?
No, it wasn't even that. It was just like, it was Saturday. I was out with some friends and it was probably 10 o'clock. And by that time, I'm usually in, right? That's, you know, getting myself ready. And I was like walking in every bar, was like shoulder to shoulder.
Right.
Like trying, I was like, what is happening here? Like, I was like, anyway.
Really young people are moving in that neighborhood because of Google, like I said. Yeah. And there's some other tech companies moving in that area. And so the residents are getting younger and younger.
Is it going to draw the crowd that's here on Hubbard Street?
Oh, they're not going anywhere. No, because I was at disco on Saturday and I had one drink and had to get out of there. It was so crowded in there.
This is right here in River North, right along Hubbard Street. I mean, the Rockets and the Paris clubs, and that's all staying there.
Oh yeah. They're safe.
Chicago is getting so, I mean, when you talk about these areas, the West Loop or right here, I mean, this is unprecedented in the sense that there are so many different areas of the city that are just popping right now that are so popular, right?
Yeah, and don't forget about Logan Square. That's pretty popping, too. And there's a new bar in that area. It used to be in an old Bonnie space, and that's a new 4 a.m. bar. And there's like four other cocktail lounges that are catering to 20-somethings, as well as sports lounges and late-night dance clubs moving into Logan Square that have never been there before. Because there haven't been places for 20-somethings to go to like really let loose.
What's your favorite of the neighborhoods we just said? Like if you had it right now, if you're like, okay, this Saturday I'm going to one of the neighborhoods to partake, would it be Logan Square? Would it be Hubbard Street? Would it be an old timer like Viagra Triangle, or are you going West Loop? What's your name?
I'd have to say Logan Square, and you know, I have to be honest because I live in that neighborhood. So if I had to travel too far to like really have a good time, that's a good thing.
That's the place to be.
Yeah, because I can jump around.
It's great to have you here. Thanks for being in studio. This is great. Adasha Townsend, a food drink expert, also the editor at GoChicago.about.com. Talking about the trends, talking about restaurants here in 2017. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Justin. Happy New Year.
Coming up at 10 o'clock tonight, very excited in Studio 435, split single. Jason Narduzzi in studio tonight performing live. Jason has been on the program before. He's got the sexiest elbows in rock and roll. And he also is a longtime performer with bands like Bob Mould, Superchunk, performed with so many. And we had a conversation with him. He started at such a young age. Can't wait to have him perform live in studio tonight, Studio 435. That's coming up at 10 o'clock. Well, you know, there's been a lot of resurgence. There's just a lot of interest in Chicago's Pedway in the last couple of weeks. A series of underground tunnels, sidewalks that connect the swath of downtown. It's something that serves as almost an urban legend. You know, everyone knows about it, but nobody's really explored the entire system. The Chicago Tribune's Blair Kamen wrote about it last week, and the city held workshops to figure out the best ways to utilize the mostly forgotten area. But to know the Pedway is to live the Pedway. Literally. Live in the Pedway. That's what our famed tour guide and download regular did last week. Margaret Hicks does walking tours of Chicago for her company Chicago Elevated, and she spent the last week underground. A full week of trying to live off the land. She slept in a hotel nearby, but she avoided coming up for air, light, anything, really. Margaret Hicks survived, and she's lived to tell about it. She's my guest tonight on the download. Margaret, good to see you.
Hi.
You made it. You're alive.
I'm alive, and I'm pretty sane.
You are?
Mostly.
You came out. Today was the day that you came up for air.
I came out on Sunday.
Okay.
But I wanted to go back in today because it's unpleasant.
All right. So talk about what spurred you to do this in the first place.
So I've been giving Pedway tours now for 7 years, almost to the day. So I felt pretty confident with it, but I came up with this new idea that it was actually our 78th neighborhood. And I started playing with that idea. And then this kind of came about because I wanted to prove it. Could it actually sustain me? Could I live inside and get everything I need from on, in, or attached to the Pedway system? And I think I succeeded.
And so the caveat being that you did sleep in a hotel.
I did.
So you weren't sleeping like on the.
That's right. And that's, you know, that's illegal. And yeah. that was not the point. The experiment was, is it a neighborhood? And I have a relationship with the Fairmont anyway. I've been starting tours there for years. So that was a nice little bonus.
Okay, so the rules were that you couldn't necessarily go outside.
No fresh air.
Like, no, did you get close to some of the stairwells?
Oh, yeah, I would stand like in between the trains, like the red line, and I gave free tours the whole week. Gave free tours each day, and we donated any tip money to the Chicago Coalition for the Homeless. And but I would get in between the trains and say, "Oh, that's fresh air." And this one lady said, "That is the saddest thing I've ever." That in between the trains was my fresh.
Yeah,
air.
In between the trains. Yeah. That's your new.
Yeah.
That should be the name of your book.
Yeah.
Right. In between
maybe,
the trains.
Maybe.
All right. So what did you? You knew a lot. You've been doing tours for 7 years, as you said. What did you learn that you didn't already know about the Pedway system?
So I learned a couple of technical things. I learned about a couple elevators I've been looking for. Some kind of couple. I know there must be a way to get down there. And then my really big victory, my biggest victory, was I knew I could use the parking garages to get further than we thought. So one day I used the parking garages and I got to the restaurant in the middle of Millennium Park. I got to the Park Grill. Like, I came up in the Park Grill. What am I doing here? The ice skating rink was right in front of me. And that was really neat, just completely inside, just by kind of navigating the parking garages under Millennium Park.
Well, I mean, the Pedway system, and we'll talk about it as well. I mean, there has been a resurgence in the last couple of weeks, just, you know, I think coincidentally maybe about around the workshops and Blair Kamen and what you're doing. Yep. But I mean, this is a series of really almost a planned underground walkway that connects downtown Chicago. And but it's rarely used. Why?
So there's the biggest problem with it. There's no overseer. There's nobody in charge of it. It's not really the city's responsibility. It's each building's responsibility. So it's hard. Who's going to advertise it? Who's making maps? Who's making wayfinding devices? Who's running the show? Really nobody. So the Environmental Law and Policy Center is who's been running these workshops. And I went to one of those because it was in the cultural center.
You're like, hey,
so I could
fits.
Go.
Right, right.
So I went to a meeting about the Pedway in the Pedway during my week in the Pedway. So it was really meta. And it was really neat. And that was one of the other things I learned about the Pedway. There are a lot of people who love it. There
really?
Are Pedwayers. There are people who care about the Pedway and are interested in it and fascinated in it. And now they're my Pedway friends.
So when you were in your experience and you were walking around, I mean, one of the big things about sort of constituting a neighborhood in Chicago is about the regulars, about the people that you're going to walk by or people live there. Obviously,
people live.
I mean, talk about that. I mean, is there a certain community of Pedwayers that you experienced?
Oh, my gosh. They're really like, I really have friends down there, like actual friends. A great person to know is Steven, who's the streetwise guy under Macy's. And I asked, Steven's really awesome and friendly, and I asked Steven if he thought it was a neighborhood, and not even a second, he said, it's definitely a neighborhood. He said, I see people, and he's saying hi, and he's waving, and we're both waving, and I just recently introduced myself to Frank De La Franza, who runs the men's salon under the Hyatt, and he used to cut Harry Carey's hair. You Google Celebrity Barber Chicago and Frank De La Franza comes up. This guy is a Chicago staple. It's awesome under there. So there is so much more to it. You really, really weird. And I think the pedway makes you work for it a little bit. Like, you kind of, you need to give it some time and some attention. It's not just going to give it up for you.
Okay.
It's not.
Margaret Hicks, Chicago Elevated in studio. She spent the last week of her life living in the pedway, the series of tunnels. I don't want to say tunnels. That's not right. Cities of sidewalks, hallways that are underneath downtown Chicago. You know, as I know, and you talk about these places, it's got to be a little bit confusing when you say, oh, well, there's parking lots, and I came up and I was in the Millennium Park Grill or under the high. I mean, what really it is this way that you can access all the buildings along sort of Michigan Avenue, really, by coming in from the basement. That's the idea, right?
It is. But some parts of the pedway are over the street. Some parts of it are kind of bridge-like.
Really?
So some parts of it are separate from the whole building, like under Macy's. So sometimes it's, you can't label the thing.
Okay. I'm interested, though, because, you know, as I know the pedway system. You're going to know under Macy's because that's famous, right?
Yeah,
that's sort of like the cafeteria thing down there, right?
Yeah, I think that's a really common spot.
People understand
it down there.
The train, the South Shore train.
Yep, that's a good spot.
Right, everyone knows that because there's going to be subway and I can understand, like, automatically when you say I lived off the pedway.
Yeah.
Well, there's a lot of restaurants and things
for
commuters. Beyond that.
What about, like, City Hall, Daly Center, Thompson Center?
I didn't know that there
Chicago were. Chicago Title and Trust. That's really neat under there. It's all really white, stark white.
I wouldn't think the title company would have a pedway spot underneath, but they do.
Yeah, it does. It does. And, you know, all that cultural center. And so that's all pretty interesting. And then over on the other side there, all that Illinois Center, Michigan Avenue, all the hotels, the Hyatt, the Swiss Hotel, Aqua, Fairmont.
They all have pedway.
They all have it. Yeah.
And you said that the hotels or the buildings above are in charge of the pedway space. Does that mean by design? Meaning they're all designed differently?
Pretty much, yeah. So that's one of the things I love about it. It's constantly changing as you move through it. And one of the things people talked about at that meeting that I really loved was kind of dissolving the top of the building and the bottom so that when you were crossing through under Macy's, it was really, really clear that you were under Macy's or under the cultural center. Like, let's bring some of the art from the cultural center into that part of the pedway. Let's thin that veil so that it's more familiar. And when you get confused down there, it can start to feel a little unsafe.
Well,
that's mentally.
That's always been a knock because there are spots where it gets dark and there's some that just historically have been unkept, if you will.
Sure.
In studio with me, Margaret Hicks. She is a tour guide here in Chicago. She does walking tours of Chicago with her company, Chicago Elevated. She just spent a week living in the pedway. She lived in a hotel. She stayed in a hotel. She wasn't just sleeping on the ground. That's illegal. But she spent a week sort of exploring what she knew and what she didn't know about the pedway. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and we'll talk more about her experience here on The Download. Stay with us. Moving right along like you would in the pedway, Margaret Hicks. Just came back from a Sunday to Sunday excursion where she lived, breathed, and I guess explored the pedway, the underground system here of sidewalks and hallways and sort of the 78th neighborhood of Chicago, if you will. Margaret Hicks does walking tours here in Chicago with her company Chicago Elevated. This idea, you know, you said you got a little pushback because people wanted you to sleep down there. They wanted you to sleep on the ground.
I think they just had a different idea of what the experiment was. The experiment was not to live and sleep in the pedway. The experiment was, is it a neighborhood? And that would be an interesting experiment, would it? And there are, you know, homeless people. That is an issue that the pedway has. But it's not...
What do you mean issues? So people sleep down? They do actually sleep down there? You see people sleeping?
People under there, but it's primarily in spots. Like under Macy's is kind of one of the notorious spots. But the reason it's not so much of a problem in the pedway, or as much as you might think, the pedway belongs to the building above it. So generally the building above it is not letting that happen in their building.
Right.
So it's not as common as you might think. And those guys down, I mean, those guys have been there forever.
Let me ask you, I mean, you mentioned right at the tail end, and I've known this, and I know this about the Pedway, being from Chicago, that there are dilapidated points in the system that are underdeveloped.
True.
Empty storefronts or maybe on, you know, areas where it's not lit.
Yeah.
Things like that. And that's when you talk about this sort of, you know, I don't want to say crime, but this danger aspect of this, you know, nobody's around kind of thing in Chicago. Is that still present and prevalent when it comes to the Pedway?
I think that the Pedway seems more scary than it is, and that I think sometimes what that fear really is just not knowing where you are. And that alone can be very disconcerting and very freaky and very scary. One of my big pieces of advice when exploring the Pedway is to not let it get there. Don't get frustrated by it. Don't get scared by it. It's really safe, even when it looks kind of iffy. It's safe. I promise you, they know you're in there. They're watching. They see you. This is the building. They're responsible for it. So,
well, that made me feel a lot better.
Yeah, good.
Just eyes on me at all times.
I have never honestly and truly, yeah, right. It's like Big Brother, but it is in there. I've never been afraid in there. Never for real afraid.
Well, there were workshops, as you mentioned, and there was a big piece that was in the Tribune, which I thought of you, and I was like, oh, wow, you guys should coordinate the two
of
you.
We did.
But, you know, you have done 7 years of tours, like you mentioned, and now you've had 7 days straight of living in the Pedway. What are your thoughts about what can be improved down there to really truly make it the 78th neighborhood of Chicago?
I think first and foremost, and one at least the simplest answer right away is the wayfinding devices, the marking, the symbol looks like a compass and it's not a compass. That symbol that you see of the Pedway, it's a compass and it's really not. So don't use it as one if you go down there. But even that's
what do you
hard.
Mean? Wait,
so the symbol of the Pedway,
it looks like a compass. So it's actually tricking you to think, oh, I'm going north, but
right.
You're not really.
And it's not. It's not a compass. It's just a symbol. It's like a compass rose. Yeah. So that's confusing in and of itself. And then that's not consistent. So it's not in every building. There's hardly anything on the outside of the buildings telling you to come in and get the Pedway. So I think that's first. If we can get something a little more consistent, but even still, that means you have to go to every single building on the Pedway, get them to acquiesce with whatever it is you want to do. Is it going to be lights on the floor? Is it going to be something above, next to you? And are all the buildings going to say, great, and then do this thing? So that's its biggest complication, I think, is that it's owned by so many different parts.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be interesting to bring people together. But it's to the benefit of the building
there. Because someone just texts right now saying, I love the Pedway. I used to work there all the time. You know, there's post office, drugstore. You can do so many different things. Is it well traveled? I mean, is it worth the investment of the city or the buildings coming together to modernize or use technology or to create a map in some form? Or is it just sort of medium, you know, or used in a way that just, you know, it's not worth the effort?
Right. I mean, I feel like it's worth the effort, but then I also feel this classic fear of gentrification of the Pedway. Like,
Once those artists move in with their
guitars
and stuff.
Right? Like, don't take away what makes it amazing, which is that it changes from building to building and it's kind of an exploration and nobody really knows about it and it's kind of a mystery and that's really what's fun. But it does deserve some love and attention. It really does. And I'm really glad that there are people out there who care about it and are working to make it better. Because if we make it better, then people will build more of it. And then maybe it'll go across the river.
Is that a possibility? I mean, is it a possibility that
the city would have
expansion?
To do that, I suppose. But, oh, sure. I mean, it's expanding now. You know, if you go, you know, that whole New East Side over here, Lakeshore East, a lot of those new buildings, those residential buildings, are adding Pedways.
Really?
You have to now. That's part of the reason why those people are moving in there. So I think it's absolutely something that's still growing. It's not this old archaic thing. It's still here.
You know, if there's, you know, 630 asks, is it patrolled by the Chicago Police Department? Is there a map? 847 says you Google and there is a map. So there's a map.
So there's a couple different maps. Even the city made a map. A couple other people have made a Pedway map, and they all look the same, which is confusing. So there is information out there about this stuff. Yeah.
So do you think that, you know, especially at this time of year, when it's cold and you start to get into the blahs of winter, that it could be a place in which could have some usefulness for more Chicagoans if they knew about it?
So that's what kind of they're talking about in these workshops is could we make it a destination? And in New York, you know, they're working on the Low Line. I don't know if you've heard about those, but it's really cool and it's really green. Like, it absolutely is kind of this oasis. And if the Pedway is a winter destination, what if we made at least a section or a couple of sections like those little parklets, right? Like little inlets of the Pedway where you could go sit by some green things that are alive. Wouldn't that be kind of amazing down there?
Well,
I think there's space for that. You know?
Paved the way by being alive, staying alive for seven days.
Yeah.
Margaret Hicks, she is the tour guide for Chicago Elevated. She does walking tours all over downtown, the area. It's great. You should go do it. Spent 7 days living in the Pedway. She slept in a hotel. What was the best part about, last question, what was the best part about getting out? And then what was the worst part?
The best part about getting out, I had a tour that morning. It's an outdoor tour. So we went right to the lake. And it was just the big expansiveness of the whole thing. And choice, like being able to go wherever I want, is really nice. And I think the worst thing was like maybe just today. Maybe just like one big, long, rainy day. I was like, it should have been today. Should have been today.
So something tells me you're going back in the Pedway tonight.
You know it.
All right. Margaret Hicks, thanks so much
for
coming
in.
Good to see you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. All right, it is time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer right here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. My guest tonight, Jason Narduzzi and Split Single. Narduzzi plays music in several rock bands, including with Bob Mould and Superchunk. Split Single is his solo project, and he's got a new album out called Metal Frames. Jason Narduzzi has the sexiest elbows in the industry, and he's in studio tonight alongside singer Jennifer Hall, and here they are. With the track Glory. Take it away, guys.
Glory wants her life right, but she can't resist the fight. These knives are sharp and clay. There was someone she knew who is magnets to her moon, till she scorched the earth ceiling. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. She found troubling harmonies in charges on repair. Look at our past side by side, so little lies could hide. True maggot rivalries. In her eyes. what the devil has drawn from you. Look what the devil has drawn from you. Look what the devil has drawn from you. Look what the devil has drawn from you.
Jason Narduzzi, split single in studio, along with Jennifer Hall. The new album is Metal Frames. Jason Narduzzi returns to the download. This is his second time through, first time performing. And come on up to the microphone. We'll talk a little bit before we go to break. Jason, of course, plays with bands like Bob Mould and Superchunk, other bands like that. Good to see you. Thanks for coming back. We appreciate it.
Hey, Justin. Thanks for having me back.
It's great to have you perform like that. It's interesting because last time we talked, we'd kind of gone through all your music, and it was fun to think back to, you know, even the stuff you were doing with Verbo and all the other stuff. But Split Single was kind of, we referenced it. We didn't talk a lot about it.
Yeah.
Talk about this as sort of your go-to solo project.
Well, it's, such an honor for me to play with Bob Mould and Superchunk. And in those bands, I'm playing a supporting role. I'm a band member, a band guy.
Yeah.
And I love it. I get to play bass and sing backup vocals, and I love both bands. And I mean, Bob Mould is like, I grew up on his music with Husker Du and his solo stuff. And there's that. And then there's, you know, I'm a singer-songwriter myself. I started as a young little guy.
Little guy. We talked about that last time.
We
too,
did talk about that.
Were you 10 or younger?
I was 10, yeah. And and so I wanted to do it again. I mean, I felt like I had a band in the 90s called Verbo, and we did a couple records for Epic, and we were really fortunate to be during, you know, making rock music during that time when people bought records and there were budgets and there, you know, we got to do some really the stuff you dreamed about when you were a kid. And then, but that second record was tough for me. I think I'd done three records in a row and I didn't get received very well. And so I was sort of, my confidence was low, and I wasn't writing songs so much anymore, but enjoying the role of being a, you know, a support guy, band guy. And then in 2012, Steve Dawson from the band Dolly Varden here in Chicago asked me to play at Shuba's with him just to open up. And I agreed to do it. And I just had this moment where I thought, well, you know what? I'm just going to write all new songs. And that's how Split Single started.
Are you playing all the parts on this record?
No. The bass is played by Chicago and John Stirrett from Wilco. And the drums are played by John Worster, who's in the Bob Mould band with me and Superchunk. And he plays with the Mountain Goats and many other people. And I had Nora O'Connor sing a bunch of backing vocals. Yeah. Steve Dawson is on a couple tracks.
You know, it's just amazing because the names you throw out are, you know, they're such a great, I mean, these are great musicians that you're playing with. And what I really love about, you know, since we talked, and this was probably a year ago, but what I love is I've been following you on Instagram and pops up, and here you are playing with Bob Mould, and here you are at this festival, and here you are living this life. It's like, but it is, there's something about the fact that you know, it's not just one musician. There's a community of musicians. It seems like you guys help each other out on all your projects.
I think that I've been fortunate to have connections with certain people, you know, personal connections. I wouldn't say that musicians all help each other out. But I think a Split Single is a nice vehicle for me because I do get to write the songs and sing them. But then there are times when Friday night I went, or Saturday night, two nights ago, I went to see Tommy Stinson at Cobra Lounge. My friend Steve Selvage plays guitar in his band. Steve's also in the Hold Steady. And we were talking about this, how we have these, you know, close friendships of guys who are in other bands. And it's cool. Sometimes we get to play music together. And there was this pause. And he goes, man, just so you know, if you ever need some help with Split Single, I was like, are you going to be at South by Southwest in March? He goes, yeah. I go, cool, we're on.
That's how it works. I mean, that's the beauty of it.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is interesting because, I mean, as a world of musicians, especially when you even mention it yourself, I mean, a friend said, hey, do you want to open up at Shuba's? You know,
yeah.
I mean, there is this sort of like this world in which you, when you're traveling the way you travel, and the way that you're playing with bands like Bob Mould or Supertrunk. I mean, you are, there are two opening acts and there are friends, and I mean, you are developing a network of, yeah, of some festivals. Of the best in indie rock.
Well, the festivals too, because there's just so many bands on those bills. But I'm just very fortunate, and thankfully, my family is patient with me in adding a third band to the.
Are you the kind of musician though at the festivals you get your dressing room and you're like, I'm out, man, don't talk to me, this is where I'm at, like the Sebastian Bach memoirs that I've been reading, or are you the kind of guy who floats around and
I'm pretty
creates
social.
New relationships?
I'm pretty social, but I can get quiet or private, you know. But I like to see music, and I'm invigorated by a lot of the newer acts out, and I like discovering new music, new bands. So the festivals are a great way to do that.
Yeah, Jason Narduzzi in studio with me tonight. His solo project, Split Single, is out now. Metal Frames is the record. Okay, we'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll get some more live music here in Studio 435 with Jason Narduzzi.
Thank you.
Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN, Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer, right here on beautiful Michigan Avenue. Jason Narduzzi in studio. Split Single is his project. His record is called Metal Frames. He's performing live today. Jennifer Hall also in as well, accompanying Jason. You know, Jason, we're talking. It's so interesting because Chicago has such a robust music scene. And I always think of like bands like the bands you play with. They're not Chicago bands. We kind of talked about this before that, I mean, yeah. It is interesting that there is such a connection to a lot of the bands that don't call Chicago home to this area because of the musicians that play with them, or just the fact that this is a town that has a lot, is a place for artists to live.
Yeah, I mean, Chicago is Bob Mould's strongest city as far as ticket sales and record sales. So
really?
There's that connection. But yeah, Chicago. I mean, I love Chicago. I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying here.
You know, as you play, like with a Split Single, like where would you want to play? If you could have any place you want to play in Chicago, where would be the place that you're like, okay, this is where I want to have my record release party or whatever it is?
Number one would be WGN Radio.
Yeah, sure.
Sure. Number two, I mean, we've been really fortunate. We played Pritzker Pavilion, Millennium Park. We opened up for Wilco at the Riv. We played Metro a bunch. I love Shuba's. I love Space in Evanston. There's so many great venues.
Yeah.
And so I don't know if I could answer
do
that.
Let me to get us out of the sort of diplomatic problem that we're in here, let's talk about other cities. You know, as you tour the country, yeah, and you continue to go to the same cities in your career, and you've played with so many different bands, are there some places where they'd be like, hey, we're playing the Fillmore tonight, and you're like, no, I can't stand the sound of that place, I don't like the smell of it, like, are there places?
The Fillmore's great.
Whatever the film, not the Fillmore, but, you know, just certain places.
Yeah, there's like, I mean, we won't name names, but there's definitely a couple that you come across. Well, you know, one that got much better, the Paradise in Boston has been there for a very long time. I mean, I play there with Bob, but Husker Du used to play there in the 80s. And they just didn't have a bathroom backstage, which is the worst. I mean, it's just, now I sound so, like such a diva, but
no, I think a bathroom, I mean,
you really have to
pee,
and then it's like you can't, there's nowhere to go. So they changed that. So now the Paradise is much more comfortable.
As you guys, you know, Bob Mould and even Supertrunk to an extent, I mean, do you get the sort of a better experience as you guys get older and there's just more famous in the way that you're coming around? I mean,
well, Bob's on fire right now. I mean, his last three records have just done so well. And so we're really fortunate. I mean, we get to play really fun.
But is it changed from the idea of playing, you know, or sleeping in the back of vans,
yes,
to now you guys are living a more adult lifestyle as you
tour
me, the world.
Bob told me
roll.
Husker Du once played 17 shows in 14 days. So yeah, we're not doing that. There's hotel rooms, there's a crew,
How often are you on the road?
That's a good question. A lot of people think I'm touring all the time. In 2013, both Bob and Superchunk were on album cycles. So I went to Europe three times, Australia twice, many times in the U.S. But at the end of the year, my wife and I added up the days I was out of town for the whole calendar year, and it was 27% of the time. And that's, I have friends that that have jobs that take them out of town 50-60% of the time. So both bands are really smart about how they tour. They'll go out for 10 days, come home. 2 weeks, come home. Weekend, you know, it's...
You have to think about that, you know, especially when you have families and you get older. You can't just sort of like keep going. And I mean, there seems to be some smarts that are added.
It's also just not interested in doing that. We could play a lot of shows, but I don't know. We don't want to. Let me tell you, when no one's raising their hand going, you know, but I want to play such and such town for the, you know.
Yeah, but I would think that there probably are. I mean, you get the young band that's out there. That's some of the bands that have been here in Studio 435. They died to play the places that you play with Bob, where you play just a split single. I mean, where they're like, I want to do that.
Yeah, they haven't done it yet. And then you do it, and then you, I don't know. Sometimes we get, like just last fall, we played some smaller markets with the Bob Mould Band because we had some festivals on either end of a weekend. So in the middle, we played... I think we played, now I'm going to get in trouble. Well, somewhere in Iowa, maybe Des Moines or something. But it was Des Moines. And, you know, we just never play there. And so it was cool to play there. People were excited to see Bob. And
You find yourself, do you still get jacked up to play?
Every night, on
stage? I mean, something.
I'm jacked up right now. Just, I mean, not only to see you. Can I call you Juice?
You can call. I would love it. Oh, okay. My God. I've been trying to get that nickname for a good 15
years. I'm Jack
because
I'm in the room with Juice.
Yeah, there we go. See? More for the movie Juice with Tupac than OJ. You know, like that's more what I was looking for. But, yeah, I'll take it. I'll take Juice.
Well, Jennifer and I parked downstairs, and I'm carrying the amp and the guitar, and she was asking about travel, and we're going up these stairs right here, and I'm getting tired and more tired. And I'm like, I must just love doing this because I just don't stop. It just doesn't matter what's going on. But it's true. I mean, I've toured with people who don't like it, and it's not for everybody. It's not only Jennifer and I were talking about this. Not only does it have the hurry up and wait cycle over and over and over, but you're also vulnerable in a weird way. You know, even with someone like Bob Mould, we taped a Carson Daly TV thing, and what they do for that show is you play in a venue and they come and record it. Well, we couldn't play an LA venue because we were playing in LA in 3 weeks, so we couldn't book a show.
Because of the radius clause.
So we had to fake a show in a way, and we were told that there would be 100 or 200 people in the room just to make it look, you know. Well, that didn't happen, and I don't know what fell through the cracks, but we walk out there to do 8 songs, and all we see is concrete in front of us. And that's what I mean by that vulnerability. You just go, well, here we are. Turn it up. Go. Do it. You know, you can't sit there and, like, whine about it, you know. So, it does take a certain – I've toured with people that just hate it. And I'm fortunate, I guess, that – you know, in Chicago, my parents divorced when I was young, and I lived in 14 different apartment buildings growing up. And I think that mentality helps me – with the touring.
And the vulnerability, there is something there. The idea that, you know, you kind of look inward to the band members and say, we're going to play our stuff. I don't care who's in the audience.
Play your stuff and have a sense of humor about it. You know, like, we got back to the dressing room and Bob shut the door and he goes, what are they going to CGI the crowd?
And they probably did.
We all fell over. We were laughing so hard.
I mean, that's part. I mean, I think you've probably experienced that in real ways, not sort of TV ways, where there's been less people in the audience than you thought there would be. And it's probably I would say it's less of an issue now as you tour with the bands and things of that nature. But, you know, talk about that relationship with the audience, because do you still get, you know, peek through the curtain, see how many people showed up at a show and things of that?
I try not to think about that. I mean, you know, in the 90s, I had a band called Verbo, and the first record came out in 97, and the very first tour we did was a 6-week tour with this band called Brad, which is a side project of Pearl Jam. And every show was sold out. So it was like Metro size venues, and Metro was one of them. For 6 weeks, every show sold out, and we're just like, well, touring is great. You know, this is.
Well, I don't know why anyone doesn't
people like
this, right?
What we're doing. We're selling records, and. And then very next show, you know, it ended in Seattle where they're from. And then the next show is in Boise because we're routing back home. And the only people in the audience were the other band and one guy at the end of the bar. And we got drunk, and our drummer took his shirt off and came up front. He just abandoned the drums and just came up and started singing lead vocal. I mean, we didn't phone it in. We gave up, you know, and turned into like a terrible circus band. The show ends, and Verbo had a cellist in the band named Allison Chesley, an amazing player who plays under the name Helen Money now. And we took pride in the fact that we were this rock band that had a cellist in the band. And we get off stage, and that guy at the end of the bar walks all the way over and goes, "Hi, I forget his name. I'm John, the cellist, and Built the Spill." And we just about fell over. We're just like, we just blew that. We just had this show where we could have impressed the one cellist in rock that we look up to. So it was a learning lesson.
That's
a great lesson. Like, it was like, don't take any gig for granted. You know, you hear those stories about like the first Police tour, and there was 15 people in the crowd. Well, they played like there was 15,000 people, and you just and then you lose yourself in the music, and it's not hard. It's not a hard job, I don't think. It's the best third job I've ever had. Let's put it that way.
Jason Narduzzi in studio. Split single, his project, the album Metal Frames. We'll take a quick break for the news. We'll come back and we'll get some live music from Jason Narduzzi and Jennifer Hall, who's in studio here on Studio 435 on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Time for Studio 435. We continue our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer right here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Jason Narduzzi, split single in studio. The new album is called Metal Frames. Jason Narduzzi is accompanied by Jennifer Hall, singer Jennifer Hall. And here they are with the track Blank Ribbons. Take it away, guys.
Charms of pain, false requiems, plastic trophies and blank ribbons, seduced again, now for the first time. Uniforms of fake bravery, authority and from nothing, the threat of steel, so you won't feel. Shirts will fall from the sky. Celebrity will feed the eyes. Seduced again, now for the first time. Shiny rims, empty souls, toxic faith leak, bullet holes. There's no time, there's no time.
Jason Narduzzi, split single, along with Jennifer Hall in studio. The album is called Metal Frames. That track was Blank Ribbons. Jason Narduzzi is going to be playing up at Shuba's on April 22nd, a little further down the line. But he will be there. Split single will be there. Do you find yourself?
There's still tickets.
There's still tickets available.
There's still. Last time I checked, which was just earlier today, the venue said all the tickets are available.
Right.
All of them.
That's good. That's good. That's strong. That just means that
thanks,
people,
Mom.
They're anticipating, but they're also giving you space.
She said she was going to buy a ticket.
What are you going to do? Maybe it's a ticketing system. Maybe it goes down. You know, it's
going to be it.
Technology. I always blame technology, right?
Give Mom another day.
I'm interested in your career because this record, it's interesting to think about Verboe. And even when you were younger, you were playing punk music. You were playing, you know, sort of Cubby Bear. You were a young kid. You then moved into sort of the alt-rock thing. You play in other people's bands and support. What's the influence for this music? I mean, you have such it's a melodic sort of, I don't know, it's really in a great way a softer version of what I've heard your career, some of the stuff from mm-hmm. before. Talk about how this project and this music has evolved for you.
I think the influences are still the same. You know, this album has a little bit more of some punk rock influenced stuff. Not the songs we're playing right now, but there's a song called White Smoke that's got a little piss and vinegar to it. Can I say vinegar on radio?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, you can.
You know, like there's a song called Untry Love, which is to me just sounds like Cheap Trick, you know, not as good, but very influenced by Cheap Trick.
Do you find yourself going back to the same influences that you sort of, you know, were at your impressionable age?
I think it's all over the place. Sometimes I'll hear a song by a band that I've never heard that I like the rhythm to it, and I'll get my phone out and just sing that drum beat into my phone, and that'll turn into something. Or sometimes I'll just be just in the basement and messing around with chords, and something happens. In fact, the song we're going to play next, if you'll allow us, if we pass the audition, was me messing around with a weird guitar pedal that just kind of made a guitar chord just extend out. It's called a compressor. It just makes the chord go forever, and that inspired the song "Leave My Mind" that we're going to play. But it just sort of varies. That's a good question. I know Bob Mould has a collection of 45s from when he was a kid. His dad owned a grocery store, and there was a jukebox in the grocery store, and he would give Bob all the 45s that he could find, and Bob still has those.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that when he gets into a songwriting rut, he's told me that
he goes back.
Yeah, he gets those out.
What do you go back if you go in a songwriting rut? What are
they going to do a rut?
Yeah, is it the kind of music like Cheap Trick or some of the stuff
sure.
that from the early?
Yeah, like, or even like, I mean, right now I'm listening to this Milwaukee band called Midnight Reruns that I think are just great. They're just, you know, they're like 23 years old, and they're hot, man. It's a hot rock band that just makes sense to me. And so sometimes I'll hear that and go, that's a cool riff. You know, what if I did something like, you know, my version of that, and what would that turn into? So it's really all over the place.
Jason Narduzzi is my guest tonight, Studio 435. He's going to play some more music before we close up here. But I'm interested. I think we talked about this last time too, but this idea of musicians want to be comedians want to be rock stars. I mean, it's all intertwined. I mean, you play with John Worster, who...
Very funny.
Very funny guy, yeah. Writer on a lot of great stuff. And you've, you know, with the sexiest elbows, I kind of made a joke at the top, you got the sexiest elbows in the industry, but you put out a web series that has a really sort of talking about, you know, the idea of you having the sexiest
right.
elbows, and you get great cameos from other musicians and actors and comedians. Where does that come from? I mean, are you always sort of reaching to do more sort of artistic projects outside of music?
Well, that whole thing came about because there was a benefit at Second City that Steve Albini and his wife Heather put together, Letters to Santa.
Yeah, right. Every year, right?
Yeah, it's an incredible thing. And that, I think it was 3 years ago I was there, and Fred Armisen was there, and we had met a few times before, and he just came up to me and said, I think your posts on Instagram are really funny, which is so sweet of him to say. He doesn't have to say that.
Yeah, right.
And of course, when somebody that you admire their work, you like run back and go like, well, what is he talking about?
I got to look back.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
What
which
have
ones?
I been doing?
Yeah. And it happened to be the one where I found this old press photo where I look like I'm lifting my sleeves up. And I just wrote a silly caption that I had a manager that felt like I had the sexiest elbows in rock music. And I had to show my elbows in all the press photos. So I reached out to Fred and I said, well, because I love his character Ian Rubbish, which is a British punk rocker who loves the Queen. Yeah. And I said, would Ian Rubbish have any interest in making comments about the sexiest elbows in rock music? And he did. And then I asked a bunch of other people. So the first one came together really quick. And then these next, the more recent two that we filmed, which I shot with The Onion, which they were great to work with. I pitched them on the idea, and they were incredibly helpful. Leo Garcia and Josh Modell and Rick Hammond and all those guys over there. And that was this one was more of a drawn out storyline thing, like a day in the life type thing.
Well, there's cameos from Michael Shannon and Jeff Tweedy and Fred Armisen and all these great actors and musicians who play in. But the way it works is you, man. The way that you just sort of accept the reality that you have sexy elbows. But, you know, you want to move on. You're more than just your elbows. That's kind of the beauty of the web series.
I will be a guest on your show anytime you want, Justin. You just keep saying things
bring,
like that.
Bring the elbows. You got to bring the elbows. Yeah.
Please keep saying stuff like that.
But where can we find that? I mean, where's the home for that? Just YouTube?
Yeah, it's on YouTube.
Just put in sexy elbows?
Yeah, you're not going to believe this, but if you type in sexiest elbows in the YouTube, nothing else comes up.
That's going to change.
I mean, I think what happened with that is that it's such an absurd idea that when I would ask, you know, like Dave Grohl and all these people to do it, they're just like, tell me one more time what this is. And I tell them, and they're like, yeah, let's do it. It's sort of fun. You know,
is it the kind of thing where you just have to steal a half hour of their time?
5 minutes. half hour with some of those people is like.
But I know it. I mean, I've done web series like that too, where you're like, you get somebody's time. You're like, here's the bit. We're going to do it.
Whenever you can do it.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I mean, for like with Frank Black in one of them, I auditioned for the Pixies. I got a hold of him and I drove straight to his workspace. You know, I was like, I will take 3 minutes of your time. Unfortunately, we've toured together before and, you know, we ended up having lunch and stuff, but I just didn't want to put him in any situation. You know, with Jeff Tweedy, we went straight to the Wilco recording loft. And I just try to, you know, make it as easy as possible for them. And fortunately, I mean, everybody's so great in it. They're just so funny. You mentioned Todd Berry. He's hilarious.
Todd Berry's great.
Dave Hill is incredible. It's a lot of fun. And it's nice for me to, I mean, you asked where it comes from. You know, when you're touring, you have a lot of downtime. And so, you know, you see weird things and you just sort of like go, what's going on?
Do you have more in you? Are you going to do more episodes?
Well, it's funny you ask, Justin. I love this show. I posted something on Instagram last February before a Bob Mould tour that I was practicing what I was going to do in between the songs. So it's me like toweling off and adjusting the knobs on the amp. So we just shot a new split single video for that song, Untry Love. And the whole premise is that the band is arguing about what you do in between
the songs. That's so great.
And so that should come out soon.
All right, good. We'll look forward. Yeah. Jason Narduzzi in studio, split singles, album Metal Frames. We'll have one more song from Jason and Jennifer in studio here on Studio 435 on a download right after the break. Stay with us. All right, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman, Studio 435. On now, weekly showcase of best live music in Chicago. Here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue, my guest tonight, Jason Narduzzi and Split Single. Narduzzi plays music several rock bands, including Bob Mould and Superchunk. This is his solo project. He's got a new album out called Metal Frames. He's in studio with Jennifer Hall. And here is another track, the last one tonight, Leave My Mind.
Black puddles shine and fade, reflecting back the light. Streets have emptied, everyone returns to their lives. My hands have hollowed, they won't settle down. Without a dream, they grasp for something that I've found. I must be lonely, I must be down. Mm-hmm.
A final wind on neon light flickers and dies. This town is silent, but I can't shut my eyes. No rest for broken, no rest for shame. No longer recognize the framework I had made. Why won't you leave me? Why won't you leave my mind?
Jason Narduzzi live in studio. Split Single is the name of the band, and also the album is called Metal Frames. That track was called Leave My Mind. It's playing at Shuba's April 22nd. Tickets still available for that one.
All of them.
All of them. For you, I mean, what is your schedule like in 2017 here? So you're working on Split Single, and obviously got the show at Shuba's. What about Bob Mould and Superchunk and all the other bands that you play with?
Yeah, it's all Split Single this year. There's no Bob Mould shows on the books. The possible one-off with Superchunk, but Split Single's doing show in DeKalb in February, Milwaukee in February, West Coast in February. We're going to do South by Southwest in March down in Austin, Texas.
Yeah.
In April, we're going out in the Midwest and East Coast with Kelly Deal from the Breeders has a band called R Ring. So there's a bunch of Split Single touring and videos, and
I'm always fascinated, you know, as you get older with not only the Split Single stuff with Bob Mould or with Superchunk. I mean, these are small businesses, you know, these bands. There's not sort of like, hey, they offered us a gig in Champaign on Thursday, let's do it. That part of your life is over.
Not Champaign, no.
No, right. But I mean that part, I mean, there
we get offers for festivals. I mean, that's one of the last year I did a couple of shows with Superchunk in North Carolina. So, you know, we'll go do a couple of shows here and there.
You know, for you, is it more difficult to sort of to be available for those kind of one-off kind of shows? Like if a festival comes together just because not only your own solo project, but because of your life here in Chicago?
Sometimes there's a conflict of interest. It's weird when you're a parent doing these things because you start to think about what are the most important holidays. And so all my bands know that the last 2 weeks of October, I don't play.
Because of Halloween?
That's number one, actually. Because you can't come home November 5th and get dressed up with the kids and walk down the block.
Yeah,
it just
right.
doesn't work. And then my two youngest have birthdays at the end of October. So I have those 2 weeks where I just don't play. Honestly, the other ones I don't care. You know, Thanksgiving, I don't care about it. And not that I don't care, but I can be out of town for that.
Right, right.
It's turkey and football. I can miss that.
For you, when you're working on your own work, Split Single, what's the end game? Is it the same kind of thing when you were playing with Verbo back in, is it the idea of fame and fortune, signing record labels? What is it when you're touring Split Single or you're sort of supporting a record?
I think just the joy of creating and connecting with people. You know, I think nowadays it's probably important that I do shows, you know, and I like playing shows. I'm not going to tour all the time, but sometimes. And I think the videos that we make reach some people. I mean, honestly, it's I don't know if there is an end game. I just like playing rock music and writing songs and playing with friends. And, you know, it just hasn't changed. That's how sad this whole thing is. I was 10 years old, and here I am. I'm going to turn 46 next month. And, Justin, I'm doing the exact same thing.
Okay. Last question, just about music in general. As music changes and
that got two downs.
No. Yeah, now I got to bring it back up. Patty Vasquez up next. We got to bring the energy back up. Jason killed it in the room. No, I'm interested because, you know, for you, you know, you've already talked about how important it is to be on stage and how you love to perform live music. Could you see yourself as a musician in a world where you just create music in a studio and you put out videos and you don't actually get on a stage and perform it?
I don't think about it. So I guess not. Sorry. Let me try and expand on that. All of a sudden, I became the worst interview WGN
has
ever
had.
Yes, no. No, I don't.
No.
I don't have like this I'm incredibly deep desire to get on stage. I enjoy it. But it's more, I'm not like insatiable.
We'll play like a strange, you know, adaptation of Would You Rather, but, you know, which would you prefer? I mean, if you could play on stage and in front of audiences, only record in a studio or only do videos?
Ooh, I'd probably play live. There's nothing like that, you know, when there's people there. Tickets still available for Shubas. I like that connection. I like... sometimes I'll do solo shows and it'll be more storytelling and I do like that connection and I like going to shows. I like seeing people perform and hearing new music and it gives, I guess in that way, I'm pretty social. They say that, you know, that invigorates people who are mm-hmm. social. I get inspired by that and I feel like I'm living if I'm going out and seeing music a lot. You know, like last weekend I saw Miles Nielsen at Space on Friday, and then Saturday I saw Mysteries of Life in Evanston, and then went and saw Tommy Stinson after that.
Wow, look at that.
Yeah. I mean, I just felt, you know, Sunday was like, yeah.
Jason Narduzzi in studio. He's our guest tonight, Studio 435. Split Singles, new album, Metal Frames, is out. You can see him April 22nd at Shubas. Jason, always a pleasure to have. Thanks so much for
it. Oh, it was a pleasure. It's a great time. Thank you.
All right. Well, this is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. Thanks to Bob Ferguson. Also, thanks to Jennifer Hall. We didn't get a chance to talk to her. She was on the program before. Background tonight. Coming up, Patty Vasquez, of course, takes over here on 720 WGN.